All right, well, welcome. It is December 9th, 2008 at 8:30 in the morning. We are in room 464 at the Capitol Building here in Pierce, South Dakota. This is a meeting of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission. We have with me is Commissioner Dusty Johnson and Commissioner Gary Hansen. First of all, we'll check the phone lines. Thomas Fort?
I'm here.
Thank you. Mary Loans?
Here, Mr. Commissioner.
Wendy Harper? Wendy Harper, are you with us? Todd Hansen from Beersford Telephone. Todd, are you with us? And Jerry Reisenauer?
Here, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Jerry. So, Wendy Harper and Todd Hansen, I did not get an answer from them. Is there anyone else on the phone line that I did not mention their name? If not, we will start our meeting with the approval of the minutes. But first, let me mention that we will be taking dockets TC07, 112, 113, 114, 115, 116 at the end of our agenda. Those dockets are under telecommunications. And then also, after oral arguments, we will do what is at the end of our agenda, the election of leadership. So let's start with the approval of minutes of the ad hoc commission meeting held on October 30th, 2008. Are there any changes or additions? If not, a motion?
I would move that the commission approve those minutes.
All right. Thank you. Discussion? And Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen?
Can you hear me all right?
Oh, there you are. I can now. I couldn't before.
Apparently, I have to take it off speaker when I speak, so aye.
Thank you. And Commissioner Kobach, both aye. Yeah, you're coming through very well if you're not on speaker there. Second is a status report on consumer utility inquiries and complaints received by the commission by Ms. Deb Grigg.
Thank you, Commissioner Kobach. The commission has received a total of 72 contacts since the last report was prepared for the November 25, 2008 commission meeting. 8 of the contacts involved telecommunication services, 19 of the contacts involved electrical service, 10 contacts involved natural gas service, 5 contacts involved cell phone service, 14 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry, 5 contacts involved the Green Warehouse, and 11 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 2,323 of the 2,393 complaints received in 2008 have been resolved, and 2,328 of the 2,337 complaints received in 2007 have been resolved.
All right, thank you, Ms. Gregg. Questions? I just have one. Have your phones been heating up since the weather's been going down?
No. We had a lot of disconnects before winter started that we were working on to catch people up in the summer, but it has not picked up since the snow's fallen. So.
All right. Thanks. Thank you. Next item on the agenda is pipeline safety. In the matter of PS08-004, the pipeline safety program manager now questions whether the facility in question is in their jurisdiction. The question today is how shall the commission rule on staff's petition for a declaratory ruling? We'll look to staff, Nathan, or Kara.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Kara Semler for staff. The subject facility that has raised some question regarding our jurisdiction is the Burke Housing Authority. It's a nonprofit, elderly, and low-income housing unit in Burke, South Dakota. As I described in our petition for declaratory ruling, the residents pay a set rent that is based on a formula from their income. It's set by HUD, the U.S. Housing and Urban Development. The Housing Authority itself then applies for government subsidy to offset the cost of gas. Individual usage is not metered, and although I make some points in the petition to reason in favor of jurisdiction, we do lean towards this being a non-jurisdictional facility. It is essential that the gas be resold to qualify as a system over which we do have jurisdiction. And in this case, I believe the facility itself qualifies for a subsidy and pays for it. The residents do not, and they do not directly pay for the product that they do receive. There are a lot of additional details in the petition and in some materials that have been subsequently filed, and both Nathan and I can certainly answer any questions, but we do recommend that the facility be non-jurisdictional.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone from the facility that would like to speak to this? Nathan, would you like to comment?
Carol Johnson was supposed to be here on the line. Carol, are you on the line now by chance? Apparently, we have no one from the facility.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the commissioners?
Ms. Summer, Mr. Solomon, could you describe for us a little bit what would be the effect of the commission finding that it has no jurisdiction?
They would no longer be a part of the pipeline safety program requiring compliance with Part 192 and 191 of the pipeline safety regulations. They would still be subject to voluntary compliance with the National Fire Protection Association codes that cover propane facilities. I did do some checking to see if any other agencies would have jurisdiction of any sorts over these facilities. The Fire Marshal's Office and the inspection program under the Department of Public Safety do not.
Would any additional administrative burden fall to Burke to this facility as a result of us not having jurisdiction? Would they have to file some paperwork with PHMSA or anyone else?
I believe all I have to do is drop them off of our listing of covered facilities. I believe the burden would fall on me.
Does Ms. Johnson understand the effect of what might be the commission's decision, and are you aware of any thoughts or opinions she might have?
The only thought that she relayed to me was that if they do remain jurisdictional, they are out of compliance, and there might be a burdensome cost involved to get them into compliance.
Could you provide a few more details? I mean, are people at risk if they're out of compliance? I mean, even if they're not jurisdictional, is that something that should be taken care of?
I have recommended that she proceed with taking care of a couple of things. There is no serious risk right now. There's some paperwork issues. Their plan is not up to requirements, and they probably need to do an electrical survey of the piping, which hasn't been done for a number of years, to check for any corrosion, but there's no evidence of corrosion. There's no indication of anything like that. So as far as I know, there's no immediate safety risk, but there are some things that I would recommend them doing, whether they're jurisdictional or not, and I've offered to help her with those, whether they're part of the program or not.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Nick and I just have a couple. Is that what prompted this to come before us, is that the owner would have been in some financial strains if they were part of the program?
That was my concern. Before I required them to spend that kind of money to get into compliance, I wanted this jurisdictional issue resolved so that I know I had the authority to require them to spend that money.
Okay. Kara.
In addition, Commissioner, I think, you know, when we accept responsibility for the inspection and the review of these facilities, if they are not a jurisdictional facility, I think we put ourselves at a bit of a risk, particularly when they are out of compliance, and we have to aggressively seek compliance. And so I think there's a variety of potential risk that could fall on the commission and staff if we don't truly regulate those facilities that are jurisdictional.
Sure. Just so I'm straight, their rent does not increase or decrease with the price of propane. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So under the articles that you had submitted, Kara, there was one that kind of related things to a motel or a college that do not come underneath of our jurisdiction. I kind of see that as what this facility is. Would you agree with that?
I do agree. I think, it's a service that's simply provided by the facility. It's not something that the consumers directly pay for. Their rent doesn't increase or decrease with the cost of that commodity.
I and this might be a stretch, but I don't think that they would be, if they didn't pay their rent, their heat would not be shut off.
Correct.
It's two separate bills.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you. Any other questions from commissioners? Hearing none, action.
I will move that the commission rule on staff's petition for declaratory ruling that the commission does not have jurisdiction.
Discussion on the motion. Hearing none, Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Hanson?
Aye.
And I'll vote aye also. Thank you. In telecommunications, item number one, we're going to move that to the end of the agenda. So our next item will be TC08-030 in the matter of an application of Access Point Incorporated for a certificate of authority to provide local exchange service in South Dakota. The company intends to initiate service upon approval of its application and all filed agreements. The question today is, shall the commission grant the COA to Access Point Incorporated? Is there anyone from Access Point?
Yes, Thomas Fort, consultant to the company.
Okay. Would you like to comment?
Well, yes. I'd just like to thank staff and the commission for their help in getting this application to this point. This is part of a nationwide competitive local exchange rollout for Access Point, and they do have potential clients in waiting. So as soon as we can get this approved and get the interconnection agreement done, then they will be able to start providing service to your customers.
All right. Thank you, sir. Any comment from staff, Mr. Canedo?
Thank you. This is Bob Canedo. Staff would recommend approval of the application subject to rural safeguards and subject to the condition that the company not offer any prepaid services, including prepaid calling cards, and not accept or require any deposit or advance payments without prior approval of the commission. Staff would further recommend a waiver of ARSD 2010-3203-12, which is the most recent financial statements. The company has provided financial statements, but they are for the years 2005 and 2006. And the company was granted a certificate of authority to provide interchange services in August of 1997, and we have not received any complaints, as I know of, right up today.
All right, thank you. Anyone else wishing to comment? If not, Commissioner, questions?
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Yes, please.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Canedo, financial statements were provided for 05 and 06. Why no 07 information?
We've had this application for quite a while. They filed it in the first part of February, so I don't believe the 2007 were done at that point in time.
There's been some revocation of the COA in other states since reinstated. Any particular concerns about that on your end?
Well, that was one of the reasons when I checked and see if we had any complaints, because they do have a certificate of authority for interchange services. We haven't had any complaints. They have filed all the things, you know, and each year they have to file their information with us and pay the fees. They've been in up to speed on that, so.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Canedo, you said a certificate was issued, and I know from the information we've received that a certificate was issued by Secretary of State Joyce Hazeltine back in 97, and you said we have not had any, received any complaints since that time. What type of, was it a certificate of incorporation of a corporation, or was it what was it? What type of certificate was issued by Secretary of State's office? Do you know?
Just to do business in South Dakota. What I was referring to was the commission approved a certificate of authority in August of 1997 for interchange services.
Okay, thank you. And we have not received any complaints during that period of time?
No, we have not.
All right. Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Any other comments? If none, action?
Mr. Chair, I would move that the commission approve the COA with the following restrictions, rural safeguards, not allow the applicant any prepayment, and a waiver of 2010-320312.
All right, thank you. Any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, Commissioner Johnson.
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
And I will vote aye also. Thank you, Mr. Ford.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is item number 3, 2C08-0105, in the matter of the application of Mid-Continent Communications for approval to provide local exchange service in a rural service area. Intervention was granted to Alliance and SDTA on the October 7th, 2008 commission meeting, but the commission today is how shall the commission proceed? Mr. Gertis for Mid-Continent, the moving party.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. My name is Dave Gertis. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I represent Mid-Continent Communications. The agenda item is how shall the commission proceed. There have been some filings that certainly prompted the question that's on the agenda. Initially, Mid-Continent filed a petition to serve this rural ILEC area of the Crooks and Baltic exchanges of Alliance Communications. And since that time, to clarify the record is really what amounted to is Mid-Continent has filed a motion which was then amended, and the amended motion essentially asks, number one, that the commission find that Alliance has waived the rural exemption by providing video services. And then the second part of the motion is that if the commission fails to find that Alliance has waived it, Mid-Continent then seeks a hearing on the question of whether or not Mid-Continent can be given authority to operate in the Alliance area pursuant to 251F1B, which is essentially that there's a bona fide request and that that request is not unduly economically burdensome and is technically feasible. And so that's, I think, the way it's set up now. As of yesterday, I apologize for not getting this filed sooner, but I was on vacation for a while out of the state, and while the electrons go quite quickly over the internet, there was a little mix-up on the final form of the motion, so it didn't get filed until yesterday. I have filed a motion to require Alliance to respond to discovery requests that have been pending for some time. We filed discovery requests, I believe it was back in October, and Alliance timely answered those discovery requests by refusing to answer them. The response to our discovery requests, to summarize, basically said that Alliance is not required to answer these discovery requests because it's not offering video services and it hasn't waived the petition, which of course, hasn't waived the rural exemption, which of course begs the question because the discovery requests were asking questions about facts that would indicate one way or another as to whether or not the exemption had been waived. And that, of course, so the questions that I see that are before the commission are, first, should Alliance be required to answer the discovery requests, which would then give us the information to permit the commission to hold a hearing on the question of waiver of the whether or not the rural exemption has been waived by reason of providing video services. Then there is even, if the commission grants that motion, then Mid-Continent would be able to serve the exchanges, the two exchanges. If the commission does not find that the waiver occurred, there still is a next question to be answered, and that is, whether or not Mid-Continent is nonetheless entitled to serve under 251F1B. And so that's the way it's set up. And so then the question is, does the commission want to have just one evidentiary hearing or two? I mean, I think first the commission has to decide whether or not to order the alliance to answer the pending discovery. And then assuming that that occurs, I think we have to have some time to do discovery. For all I know, alliance may have some discovery they want us to respond to before a hearing. And then we can have an evidentiary hearing on the question of waiver of the rural exemption. And then the question is whether the commission wants to also include the other questions that are pending before the question. That is, secondarily, if we're not going to qualify for a waiver, are we nonetheless entitled to serve the two exchanges by reason of the second ground that we've alleged for serving or not? And then, of course, there is the petition itself. Do we qualify under the rules of the commission? And so those are the questions that are before the commission. I have no strong feeling one way or the other as to how the commission wants to proceed on this. Now, Ms. Moore is in the room, and I'm sure she wants to talk, too. So if you want to hear her before we go too much further, that might also expedite things. So I'll leave it up to you, Mr. Chairman, as to how you want to go, but I think I've set up the questions before the commission.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Griffith. Should we go to Ms. Moore first and then staff? All right. Meredith, would you like to comment?
More than willing, huh?
Why don't you bring up a chair, Linda? I'll just move over.
Our dispute isn't too adversarial. We can sit next to one. Good morning. My name is Meredith Moore. I'm here on behalf of Alliance Communications Cooperative this morning. I would agree with...
Meredith, excuse me. I apologize for interrupting you, but I'm not hearing you very well, and I really do want to hear what you have to say.
Certainly. Is this better, Commissioner Hansen?
It is. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gerdes is essentially correct in his recitation of the history of this particular matter, and I think perhaps the last two sets of pleadings that have been filed both by Mid-Continent as well as on behalf of Alliance have likely narrowed the issues somewhat for this commission's decision. Mr. Gerdes did, in fact, file a motion to compel yesterday the discovery responses, which were served on Alliance in early October. Alliance would ask for a formal opportunity to respond to that particular pleading so that we can better flesh out for the commission the reasons as to why Alliance did not respond to the discovery responses and why it does not believe it was appropriate for discovery to be served at that particular time until such time as the commission had in fact made a determination as to whether Alliance had engaged in some sort of conduct or action that would deem the rural exemption waived under 47 U.S.C. Section 251 F1C, or whether this commission needed to undertake effectively a termination proceeding with regard to that rural exemption, which is the proceeding that's set forth in 251 F1B. What Alliance's position has been from the beginning is that it has in no way taken any actions at this point in time to waive the rural exemption that is set forth in 251 F1C. The language of that rural exemption specifically requires that the party seeking the rural exemption only waives that rural exemption if it is actually and currently providing cable services or video programming. In this particular instance, the relevant exchanges for Alliance for which Midco seeks its application to provide local exchange services are Crooks and Baltic. And at this point in time, Alliance is not providing cable service in those particular exchanges. There is, in fact, a construction project ongoing, but it's not something where it's implemented, and it's not something where Alliance can even state with any certainty as to when those services will be provided in the future. So it's certainly not Alliance's contention that it will never provide services there, but that it's not currently providing services there. So therefore, under those particular facts, Alliance's intentions are not relevant when it comes to making a determination as to whether the rural exemption is waived. What's relevant is what it is doing. So from that standpoint, Alliance would submit to this commission that the waiver argument that's been advanced by MIDCO with regard to Alliance's conduct essentially amounting to a waiver of the rural exemption isn't the appropriate way for the commission to proceed. And I think in our last response, which was joined by SDTA, what Alliance sought was that this commission, if it deems it appropriate, undertake the procedural task of essentially setting a hearing at which point the commission would determine whether Midcontinent's request to Alliance was technically feasible, was not economically burdensome, and that would be the appropriate avenue for this commission to take. What's been a little bit unusual about this particular proceeding was that when MIDCO initially filed its application, it also at the same time provided Alliance with a request for interconnection. So we've had a series of steps sort of all taken at the same time, and to date we haven't had a full opportunity to perhaps discuss with MIDCO its actual intentions with regard to the services it's seeking from Midcontinent with regard to its request for interconnection. Those have been clarified in the supplemental request for interconnection. Alliance does no longer contends that that's a bona fide request, but there are certainly still implications there with the request for interconnection that's been made by Midcontinent, which would justify further exploration of that through that hearing, which this commission could hold to determine whether the rural exemption should be terminated. And with regard to the discovery requests, some of the discovery requests that were advanced by MIDCO, it would be Alliance's position that those were aimed more at perhaps discussing confidential and proprietary business plan information that Alliance has for, at some point in the future, implementing and providing cable in these particular services. And until such time as that rural exemption is deemed waived or terminated by this commission, it's not appropriate to essentially give MIDCO in what Alliance would believe would be an unfair competitive advantage by being required to engage in significant discovery. And it's been Alliance's point to date that because Alliance isn't currently providing service in these particular exchanges, that's all the commission needs to know for purposes of the waiver, and then the next step would be to determine whether termination of the rural exemption is actually appropriate. So we would submit to this commission that you can actually take the step of setting a proceeding under the appropriate administrative rules to determine whether the rural exemption should be terminated. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Boer. You mentioned SDTA. Darla, would you like to comment on this proceeding? No. All right. Wise choice. Staff, Ms. Kramer.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. As Mr. Gerdes said, he just filed that motion to compel yesterday, I believe. And so I assume Alliance, you know, wants an opportunity at this point. I think we should let that part play out and see what Alliance's response is and give everyone adequate time to respond to that, at which point then we may have a better idea of what procedural schedule you need to set up, whether it be an evidentiary hearing, as simple as, you know, are you providing in this area or when do you intend to, or if it would be the full-blown hearing as Ms. Moore requested on the termination of the rural exemption.
So you're in effect requesting a delay or no
idea? Yeah, at this point I think Alliance needs an opportunity to respond before we set anything firm.
Okay. We'll hear from maybe Rolaine first, and then we'll go back to you, Mr. Kerr.
I just had a couple questions maybe. Does Midcontinent still contend that they are currently providing video services in those exchanges?
Yes, because it's our argument, and it's clearer in the motion to compel. It's our argument that they have proceeded far enough to where it can be said that they are capable of providing service, which we believe is tantamount. Part of the issue here is when Mid-Continent gets its, let's assume that Mid-Continent were to obtain a certificate, an amended certificate of authority so that it can provide services in the exchange, the two exchanges. There's still something like 120 days that Mid-Continent has to go through before they can actually provide the service. They have to do all of the technical stuff in the back office to interconnect with Alliance. They have to get an agreement between Alliance and Mid-Continent to provide services. And that's in an affidavit that was filed with the motion to compel. So the point being that if Alliance is able to substantively able to provide services now and is simply choosing not to provide the services, to require Mid-Continent to wait, in effect sets Mid-Continent back 120 days because it can't do anything until it gets the certificate of authority, and then there's 120 days worth of technical stuff that has to be done before they can actually enter the market, whereby Alliance can do so like with the snap of a finger. I mean, that's our position, and that's why we think it's important to have an evidentiary hearing and also to have the discovery requests responded to. Excuse me, that's a long answer, but...
So Mid-Continent does not believe that they are currently actually providing video services today.
Well, I don't know that.
You don't know that.
I don't know that. I'm taking Alliance for their word, and I'm taking Ms. Moore at her word, and I'm sure they're probably not physically providing them, but that's not the question. We believe the question is, are they capable of doing it? Because, I mean, otherwise, Mid-Continent is put at a competitive disadvantage. There's always going to be this competitive disadvantage because we've got 120 days worth of work to do once we get the certificate of authority, and they can go into business immediately.
And then for Ms. Moore, if the commission were to find that the rural exemption was not waived by providing video services, and we go to the second question, would it be your position that that should be a separate proceeding apart from the COA proceeding?
I would think it should be. I would think it could be something that would, in fact, be bifurcated, perhaps, so that the first issue with regard to the termination of the rural exemption would be undertaken first before moving on to the certificate of authority, because I think, ultimately, that question of whether the rural exemption is in place, the intent of that was to protect Alliance from requests for interconnection, from having to provide different services under the Act, which, as a rural company, it shouldn't be required to provide. And so I think that needs to be a separate inquiry from the Certificate of Authority itself and whether MIDCO has certain obligations under that. So I think it could be a bifurcated proceeding, but it would need to be something where the issues would need to be kept straight enough so that we don't necessarily cross boundaries between the two concepts of the rural exemption, of which it's Alliance essentially burden to prove that it hasn't waived its rural exemption through any conduct, or that it should not be terminated because of the nature of MIDCO's request, and then MIDCO would essentially have to prove what services it's able to offer and so on and so forth.
If the commission were to find that the rural exemption had been waived by the providing of video services, wouldn't we need something in the record that is factual, an affidavit or something, as more than, you know, your assertions in your brief?
I think that's a fair statement, Ms. Wiest. With respect to the rural exemption itself, I think it is based on facts, and this is an area where Mid-Continent Alliance would disagree, because to a certain extent it's a statutory interpretation question. whether the statute contemplates the intentions and the capability of a party to at some point in the future provide it, or whether that party is actually providing it.
Yep.
To the extent that the commission wants an affidavit from Alliance's general manager that it is not currently providing cable in the exchanges at issue, specifically Baltics and Crooks, I'm certainly willing to provide that, or I'm willing to state that on the record here today and stipulate to that particular fact.
Thank you. I guess it would be my position, it's similar to Ms. Kramer's, is that given this motion to compel, it appears that there are issues. I think the commission needs to act on that before we can set a procedural schedule and decide whether we need a further evidentiary hearing on the waiver of the rural exemption with respect to providing video services.
Do you want to state that again for me?
I guess at this point I don't think we can set a procedural schedule. I think we need to put on, you know, the next agenda or something, Nick Cotton's motion to compel discovery, and I don't know if we'll put on the other motions also, and give Ms. Moore a chance to respond to that, because that was just filed yesterday before the commission can proceed further.
All right. Thank you. Anyone else wishing to comment? Commissioner, questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Commissioner Hansen.
Thank you. This is perhaps for Ms. Wiest or Ms. Moore. I appreciate the suggestion from Ms. Wiest, and she's always more on the ball on these items than I, but I did not, Ms. Moore's explanation before us just now, basically explain what their response to the discovery request would be. That their position is that they are in the process of doing some the construction and preparing to provide the service, but that they actually are not at this juncture.
I would imagine Ms. Moore in her response is actually going to provide more of a legal argument as to why Mid-Continent's argument that the capability or the possibility of providing in the future does not actually meet the legal standard that would say that it provides video services, and Ms. Moore can speak for herself.
I see. I appreciate that, because that was my, I don't have a statute or a rule in front of me that explains just precisely what is considered, if it is not currently providing the service or whether it is at some juncture close to providing the service. Is there anything, Ms. Moore, that you can point to, or Mr. Gerdes, that you can point to, that defines that clearly for us, at what point in time has the trigger been pulled, and that that we can say that service is being provided?
Commissioner Hansen, this is Meredith Moore. I think the short answer to your question is no, and I think if there were a definitive case that existed, whether that be here in South Dakota at the Eighth Circuit or some sort of order from the FCC, I think either Mr. Gerdes or I would have cited that at this point in time of being dispositive of the particular issue. And to a certain extent, this is dovetailing into your last question as well, I think I can better provide a response to perhaps your current question by being allowed an opportunity to better respond to Mid-Continent's motion to compel and to flesh out some of the discovery requests that have been made in Alliance's position in regard to those. Because you hit the nail on the head, to a certain extent, it becomes a slippery slope type of argument. Is the particular rural exemption at issue, is it a substantial compliance type of statutory interpretation? Is it only what Alliance is currently doing? And I think I can better answer some of those questions for you in a more detailed response to the motion to compel.
All right. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, just to present Mid-Continent's take on this, I agree with Ms. Moore that we've searched high and low, and there isn't a decision from any judicial body or the FCC that we can find that defines exactly factually when is a company providing video services. We have cited a case in our motion that we believe is a South Dakota Supreme Court case that perhaps lends some light on that when it relates to providing whether or not other services are being provided. And I won't go into that at this point. But what I do want to tell you is that it's our position that those discovery requests that are now pending ask the very questions that would permit the commission to find whether or not, as a practical matter, Alliance is, in fact, capable of providing video services. Our position is that, factually, if you are able to establish all the bricks to build a building, then the building is built, and so to speak. And so that's what we believe. We believe these discovery requests are need to be answered, and then the question would be before the commission as to whether or not that, in fact, does constitute providing video services.
Thank you, Mr. Curtis. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Any other questions? I have one. Is it? I agree with. I'm going to want to take this under advisement, but Mr. Curtis, if Mid-Continent is sure that the deployment of video is imminent in those two exchanges, why would there be any technical backlog? Why wouldn't you have technicians out there today preparing to compete?
Because it requires cooperation from Alliance, and Alliance has no reason to cooperate because they say that they don't have to.
So, but she's talking about trunking. You could do... You know, NPA, NXX, things like that. You could get set up. I guess I'm just a little leery. Not leery. I guess I'm a little confused on that argument.
And of course, you're far more familiar with the technical side of it than I am. But my understanding is that in order for this to occur, we have to have an interconnection agreement, and we don't even have permission to be on their premises at this point. Now, from our standpoint, we can certainly do our part of it to the extent that we
sure.
can. But we have no access to their premises, as an example, and so that's the problem
okay.
that I'd see.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? All right. Do I need the motion to take this under advisement?
I think you would just take no action.
Mr. Johnson, is that how you're leaning? Commissioner Hansen, are you leaning towards no action today?
Yes, I think we need to have Alliance respond to the discovery request.
I agree. And that's what we'll do. Ms. Moore.
I apologize. Just for clarification, when you say respond to the discovery request, do you mean respond to the motion to compel that's been proposed by Medco?
Yes.
Thank you.
And do we need a date certain for that response?
Do you have a date, Ms. Moore, when you might respond to that?
I believe I can provide a response to the commission by the beginning of next week. That
okay.
would be my goal.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right, moving on. Thank you, everyone, for that. On TC08, this is item number 4 under telecommunications, TC08-122. In the matter of the petition of Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe Telephone Authority for arbitration pursuant to the Telecommunications Act of 1996 to resolve issues relating to the interconnection agreement with all telecommunications. The question before the commission today is, shall the commission assess the filing fee to not to exceed $75,000 on the parties to the docket pursuant to SDCL 493144? The moving party would be, I believe, Cheyenne Sioux Tribe. Is there anyone?
Commissioner, this is Karen Kramer, and actually staff put that on the agenda. It's an administrative matter to collect a filing fee, and in talking to Ms. Forney yesterday, she'll split it. it's, again, it's the usual, never to exceed $75,000, and she will bill out as the, as it becomes due and split it between the two parties, and she said $1,000 would probably be the, you know, the first bill that she sends, $500 to each.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be $500 to Cheyenne Sioux Tribe and $500 to all, correct?
Correct.
Would Alto like to comment? Darla?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the commission. I did speak with Ms. Kramer yesterday just to familiarize myself with the standard procedure. CRST does not oppose the filing fee that is proposed by staff to be assessed on them.
All right. Thank you. Talbot?
Yes, Talbot Wisorek for All Telecommunications. This is the same kind of procedure we followed in the Alliance arbitration, and Altel has no objection.
All right. Thank you. Any questions from commissioners? Hearing none in TC08-122, I'll move that the commission assess a filing fee not to exceed $75,000 on the parties to the docket pursuant to SDCL 493144. Discussion. Commissioner Johnson.
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
And I'll vote aye also. On the next item, TC08-128, in the matter of filing by Orbitcom Incorporated for approval of revisions to its switched access tariff, AT&T Communications of the Midwest filed a petition for intervention on November 21st, 2008. Today, the question is, shall the commission grant intervention to any parties that may have filed? AT&T.
Thank you, Commissioner. Bill Van Camp here on behalf of AT&T Communications of the Midwest. As the Commission is aware, AT&T Communications of the Midwest is an inter-exchange carrier and is required to pay switched access services for services it provides to its customers in the state of South Dakota. AT&T has been a participant in similar dockets and has taken the position publicly in front of this commission that as long as the provider's switched access rates mirror or are below the Quest rate, they will not object to a waiver of the switched access cost dockets or cost filings that are required pursuant to commission rule to justify those switched access fees. At this point, it appears that Orbitcom has asked pursuant to rates charged by other unknown or unnamed CLECs to charge a rate nearly double the Quest rate, and so accordingly AT&T has petitioned to intervene in this docket. There is a direct pecuniary interest of AT&T in this matter as the amount of money that it must pay to these providers for switched access directly affects the rates that it must charge its customers in South Dakota. And I'll be available for any questions.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Van Camp. Orbitcom, would you like to comment?
Thank you, Commissioner. Meredith Moore, appearing on behalf of Orbitcom this morning. I've had an opportunity to review the petition to intervene filed by AT&T. I've also had an opportunity to talk with Mr. Van Camp briefly about AT&T's intentions in this particular docket. And Orbitcom would have no objection to the petition for intervention as sought by AT&T.
All right. Thank you. Staff?
Staff would recommend granting intervention to AT&T, and they are the only party that filed.
All right. Thank you. Any questions by commissioners? Nope. Hearing none, action?
I will move that the commission grant the intervention.
All right. Thank you. Discussion on the motion. Hearing none, Commissioner Johnson.
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
And Commissioner Kovac votes aye also. Next item is TC08-129. In the matter of filing for approval of an interconnection agreement between Quest Corporation and Avera Communications, LLC. The question today is, shall the commission approve the interconnection agreement? And Ms. Simler.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. The agreement was properly filed and executed. It does not appear to contain discriminatory language. No comments were filed. Staff recommends approval.
Thank you, Ms. Sindler. I'm not seeing any names for Quest, but I'll ask. Does Quest have anything to comment? Or Avera Communications?
I did speak with Avera Communications, and they had no comments and were supportive of the filing.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner questions? Hearing none, I'll move in TC08-129 that the Commission approve the interconnection agreement. Discussion? Hearing none, Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen?
Aye.
And Commissioner Kobach votes aye also. That will bring us to leadership, which we are going to do after we hear, after we hear oral arguments in the case of TC07-112, TC07-113, 114, 115, and 116. Would anyone like to take a break? Is everyone? How about we take a 10-minute break? That would put us here at 9:35. We'll get our court reporter set up, and we'll continue at that moment. Thank you. Started here. It's about 9:37. We'll get settled into our seats. And Cherry, are you ready? All right. Our court reporter is ready. Commissioner Hansen, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay. We'll get you turned up here in just a second. Is there anyone else on the phone line from before? Jerry Reisnauer?
Wendy Harper, sir, with Vantage Point.
Who is that?
Wendy Harper with Vantage
Point. Oh, okay. How about Todd Hansen with Beersford?
He's driving.
He's driving, okay. Okay, no problem. And Mary, are you still on? I doubt it. Thomas dropped off. Todd is driving. Jerry Reisnauer, are you still on the line?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And Commissioner Hansen is with us.
Yes, I am.
Okay, very loud and clear. Anyone else on the line that I did not mention? No? Okay. So, we are on telecommunications item number one of our agenda involving TC07-112, TC07-113, TC07-114, 115, and 116. So the question today is the Commission shall hear oral arguments. Are you going to be acting as the hearing, or do we just...
Start with Ms. Moore.
What's that?
Start with Ms. Moore.
Okay. All right. Ms. Moore, you've kind of been our... It's a good thing you showed up today, because make it on the roads, because I don't know what we'd do.
We plotted along well yesterday.
Okay.
So. Tried to count for time. Thank you again, Commission. Meredith Moore appearing on behalf of the five remaining petitioners in the arbitration dockets just referenced this morning, specifically Beersford Municipal Telephone Company, Kennebec Telephone Company, McCook Cooperative Telephone Company, Santel Communications Cooperative, and West River Cooperative Telephone Company. There are five remaining issues before this commission in these arbitrations. They have been extensively briefed to date, and this commission has had ample pre-file testimony put before it and also had an opportunity to hear testimony at the time of the hearing in this particular matter. Certainly not my intention today to rehash any of what has already been heard, but rather to provide a bigger picture analysis for you and perhaps submit to you a framework by which you can undertake your analysis of the remaining issues in this particular case and to answer any questions that you might have. As the Commission is well aware, the petitioners in this particular case are required by law to allow Alltel to use their networks. And because of that, this commission has before it issues which are essentially designed to determine and govern the relationship between the parties, not only for the compensation of the traffic exchanged between the parties, but also the definitions for the traffic exchanged between the parties, the way in which that traffic should be billed, and some of the other definitions that are currently before this particular commission. I find it a little bit daunting that there have been so many impressive experts in this particular case to talk with you about all of these issues before, and yet I'm the last one standing and the last one to present argument to you on certain of those issues, and it would be foolish of me to pretend that I'm the expert on a number of those issues. So to the extent that I find that any questions posed to me might be best addressed by testimony previously offered or any sections in the briefs, I'll certainly point you to that and do my best to answer your questions. As I indicated, at the time of the hearing and prior to the hearing, you had a significant amount of detailed testimony presented to you, and recently you've had the FLEC studies themselves before you so that you can look at how that FLEC model was constructed by the experts in this case and what the inputs were that were placed into that FLEC study. As I indicated, what I'd like to do is talk about the bigger picture here and essentially the overarching concerns that the petitioners have when you look at these particular issues. As this commission is well aware, what the petitioners have done here is to develop a rate for reciprocal compensation. They are bound by specific FCC rules and regulations when looking at that and when developing that particular rate and developing the particular model that develops that rate. And that's something that's been extensively discussed by both parties in its brief, and that's essentially what the definition is of TELRIC, the total incremental long-run cost that has been advanced by both parties and that has been commented on in numerous decisions and numerous orders released by the FCC. In this case, the consultants in this particular matter, both those from Vantage Point Solutions and Consortia, developed the FLEC model. They meticulously followed the state rules and the federal rules in determining what could be included, what should be specifically excluded, and how that model was to work and remain consistent with the rules proposed by the FCC. And we would submit that that model proposed rests on not only the solid legal principles articulated by the FCC, but also upon reliable and substantiated data inputs. The two primary points of attack that have been advanced by Altel to date, and this starts at the very beginning with the response to the petition and stems through the briefs that have recently been submitted. And those points of attack are that the petitioner has failed to produce sufficient proof that its proposed rate for transport and termination does not exceed the forward-looking economic costs, and that petitioner's rate exceeds its forward-looking economic cost. And I'll submit to you that distilled to their essence is what those two arguments essentially state is that the petitioners in this particular case have proposed to you a network that is too large and too expensive. And I think that argument wholly misses the mark. And that's the fundamental distinction between the arguments advanced by the parties in this particular case. Because what Altel has effectively done is it has viewed the testimony advanced by Mr. Nathan Weber, the engineer who designed the networks that have been proposed for purposes of the FLEC study, in exclusion to that of Mr. Eklund, who testified on behalf of these petitioners and developed the model and then took the information from Mr. Weber with regard to the networks and included that in the FLEC study and excluded that which by law cannot be included in the FLEC study. And those roles are very significant. And where I think the parties disagree is how those roles should be viewed by this commission. As I indicated, Mr. Weber was the one who designed the forward-looking network for the petitioners. He designed it such that if one of these petitioners called him up and said, we'd like this network deployed tomorrow or implemented tomorrow, it could be done. And in looking and developing a forward-looking network, some items that the FCC does not allow to be included for purposes of a FLEC study have to be included because that is how a network is constructed. And that is where Mr. Eklund came in with respect to the FLEC model in this particular case. He took the information from Mr. Weber the specific data, the specific study inputs, and he made a determination based upon a review of Telric, based upon a determination of what costs should be excluded, and he pulled those out. And that is where the parties have essentially disagreed to date, is whether Mr. Weber deployed a network that comports with the Telic principle, that it be forward-looking and the least expensive, and whether it has appropriately excluded non-usage sensitive costs or costs that are not necessarily associated with the termination of an Alltel call. And we would submit to you that the record certainly establishes that it does in this particular case, that the model does in fact comport with Telric in that particular regard. Mr. Weber could not design a deployable network for these petitioners that would only handle wireless traffic or that would only be designed for Alltel traffic. That's neither efficient in a cost perspective, nor is it technically feasible, nor does it comport with reality when it comes to actually looking at the network that needs to be built for these particular companies. And what it effectively does by saying that Mr. Weber has designed a network that that's too big and for which its capacity may never be exhausted, it ultimately oversimplifies the issues to state that. This wasn't a gold-plated network by any stretch of the imagination. Rather, it was a network that was designed and deployed to meet the petitioner's current and future needs, not only as it relates to voice traffic, but also as it relates to other users who are on this particular network. Alltel isn't the only user, and therefore, to design a network that doesn't account for that simply isn't appropriate, and again, simply isn't consistent with any of the case law that's out there. And to a certain extent, it's much like if an individual were to construct an apartment building with one tenant in mind and have that tenant bear the costs of the entirety of that particular apartment building. Any other tenant who moves in after that particular time would essentially be there for free. And to look at this particular network as not having been designed for a multitude of users and those other users not being required to share in the costs itself isn't consistent with Telric and essentially places a tremendous financial burden on the petitioners in this case with respect to the tools and the structure that it needs to implement in order to have networks that adequately fulfill their needs. One of the primary arguments that's been utilized by Alltel is that the OC-192 structure that has been proposed by Mr. Weber is simply too big and it's too expensive. That's not correct, again, when you look at this as being a network that is required not only to provide services for Alltel, but also for other users of that network. And I would submit to this commission that you heard testimony with regard to, one, the antiquated nature of an OC-12 or even an OC-48 for this matter. But essentially what it appears like when looking at Alltel's argument is that it is arguing that it would be better for these companies to have put in an OC-12 network at this point in time or an OC-48 network, and then every time a new user comes on or every time someone else may require a facility to upgrade that network, to add to it. And again, that's not efficient. That may be a way of achieving a lower cost for a wireless subscriber such as Alltel, but it's certainly not efficient for these particular companies, nor is it the best use of technology, nor is it the best use of resources. The goal is to set out a network which will be good for the foreseeable future, and I believe what the testimony illustrates is that Mr. Weber attempted to do that by providing for a network and providing for various switching and other technologies that would go for 5 to 7 years or perhaps even longer than that, depending upon the life of the particular technology employed. And so, therefore, to somehow start at a level which, first of all, doesn't even meet the current needs of these petitioners, but then to have to upgrade every so often simply to try to make this an exceedingly low cost is inefficient and, again, doesn't comport with the forward-looking standard or with the efficiency standard that is actually advanced and is articulated by Telerik. And so when one looks at that, that's where Mr. Eklund came in, and that's where he removed particular services that aren't necessarily employed to terminate the Alltel call. Those are the costs that are non-usage sensitive. Those are the things that he specifically identified in the Flex study and pulled out so that those particular items that aren't responsible for terminating a call aren't present and don't add to the cost. Now, there have been arguments made by Alltel, for example, with respect to the vertical costs, and if I recall correctly, there was a question voiced at the time of the hearing in this matter as to where Mr. Eklund came up with the 5% number that he used to pull out the vertical services. And by way of example, if you go back and you look at Mr. Eklund's testimony, he specifically excluded from the beginning anything that related to the vertical services, such as caller ID, voicemail, advanced intelligent network services. Those were removed. So those were never considered. So therefore, the 5% figure that Mr. Eklund then applied to that would have been to deal with any of the secondary or the remaining features that were related to vertical services. And that's a difficult number to quantify because many of those are so integrally or inextricably, intertwined with what's already present in the switch, with what's already present in the network. It's hard to put a particular number on that. And that's what Mr. Eklund did. He used his experience in having developed these models in the past, identified an appropriate number based upon his experiences, and the fact that he already knew Mr. Weber had excluded the easily identifiable vertical services, and then he pulled that out. He also went through and did eliminate the non-usage sensitive charges. Now, Alltel has argued that certain non-usage sensitive charges remain, such as Kalea, such as web self-care, and some of those sorts of things. But at the end of the day, some of those are necessary for terminating a call. Some of them may not be. But again, those are considerations that Mr. Eklund took into consideration in pulling those out. And those also have such an insignificant, whatever's left has such an insignificant effect on the ultimate bottom line that it simply does not make sense to characterize the entirety of the Flex study as including non-usage sensitive charges, because that's certainly not the case. And this is really where Alltel and the petitioners in this case differ, is in the definition of Telerik. Alltel looks at it more along the lines of the additional expenses of any incremental cost. They look at it from the incremental cost standpoint. In other words, if you terminate 100,000 minutes, what is the incremental cost associated with terminating that one additional minute to 100,001 minutes? And the petitioners, on the other hand, look at Telerik as being the standard that applies to ensuring that all users of the network share and the particular costs associated with developing the forward-looking model, terminating the costs, or excuse me, and terminating the calls that come to them. And what's interesting is this is an issue that currently is before the Federal Communications Commission with regard to inter-carrier compensation, and it's something that even in the last couple of weeks has been articulated by the FCC. And some of their most recent orders in that particular regard indicate that the current method adopted and essentially what binds the petitioners who are seeking to establish a rate is Telerik. It's not an incremental cost standard such as that which Alltel poses. That essentially is breaking it down too much. What it is the Telerik standard. And Alltel's argument is focused on that short run economic theory as opposed to the long run. And when looking at the short run economic theory, it would be impossible for the petitioners to essentially recover the costs associated with the investments that they're required to make in their networks. That's not the case when one employs the Telerik standard and when one looks at what must be done in order to recover those costs over the long term. The petitioner in this particular instance can't possibly adjust its rates multiple times at the beginning of this if there's a short-run economic theory used, such as to allow it to recover the particular costs associated with its investments. That's, again, why the advocacy is for the long-run recovery. And that is where the FCC recognizes the distinction that all who use the network must share in its cost, as opposed to simply looking at the very, very costs associated with one additional minute of use that's ultimately terminated on the petitioner's network in this particular case. So I'd submit to you that when you were looking at whether the FLEC model comports with the Telerik principles, that you need to look at it using that long-run economic theory, and whether the costs that have been included in that particular theory are essentially developed at allowing these petitioners to recover the expenditures on its network over the life of the network. That's what we've done. And again, it's something where it certainly sounds appealing when one says, well, look at these networks. They certainly don't even, these petitioners certainly don't even come close to meeting their capacity by allowing Alltel to terminate a call on this network. While that argument has some initial visceral appeal, it's simply not a correct statement with what was done in this case. And the testimonies of Mr. Weber and Ms. Vanacek and Mr. Eklund must all be viewed in conjunction with one another so that it's realized that one constructed the network and one took that network apart and went through the FCC rules meticulously so as to ensure that the embedded costs, the excludable costs that are outlined, I believe it's in 51505B, were not included. And if you look at the particular FLEC model in this case and look at the disk and the data that's included therein, you can see the methodology that was ultimately employed by consortia in this case. FLEC models aren't perfect. Telerik certainly isn't perfect. The FCC has put in place these guiding principles and these specific requirements for what must be included and what should be excluded. And that is what is to act as this commission's guide in looking at that particular model. And I would submit that that is exactly what this model does. One of the concerns I believe expressed at the time of the hearing in this matter was the age of the study. The FLEC study that has been submitted to this commission for its review was completed in 2007. It was completed using 2006 data. And part of that is because cost studies are typically done on an annual basis. That is when the entirety of the data is available to that particular consultant or company performing the FLEC study, such as the annualized minutes of use, such as the audited financial statements. In this particular case, this study was done for the purposes of ongoing negotiations for an interconnection agreement with Alltel. And when one looks at it, there isn't anything about that age or the age of the study that should give this commission any pause with respect to whether the data used in it is valid and whether the analysis employed in it is valid. It's certainly a cumbersome obligation to require these companies to update FLEC studies more often. And in fact, the FCC has specifically stated that there is designed to be an endpoint in this particular process, and that the FLEC process and the Telerik model are designed to take snapshots effectively of what is an issue in the FLEC study, and that's what's been done in this particular case. So I would submit to this commission there's no need to be concerned about the age of the study in this particular case. With respect to one of the other major issues in this arbitration, that is in regard to inter-MTA traffic and the measure of inter-MTA traffic as well as its compensation. Excuse me. This is a rather notorious issue that this commission has certainly heard before and that has been presented in other areas, and so therefore it takes on increased importance for both parties in this particular case and particularly for the petitioners. The FCC has made it clear in its first report and order, I believe it's at paragraph 1044, what the definition is of an inter-MTA call and also how that particular call should be compensated. So therefore, what is before this commission is what is the methodology that should be employed in essentially articulating the appropriate percentage of interstate use factor that should be applied to determine the inter-MTA traffic at issue. What has been advanced by the petitioners is called the telephone numbers method or the SS7 analysis that was performed and discussed by Mr. Thompson in this particular case. The petitioners would submit to you that the telephone numbers or SS7 analysis provides a reasonable approximation of the inter-MTA traffic terminated to these petitioners. Again, no study is perfect. It simply can't be, but studies certainly are not unusual in the telecommunications industry. This is a study that allows these petitioners to look at their own data, to propose a number that is a reasonable approximation that alleviates many of the concerns advanced by Alltel with regard to time consumption, effort, with regard to the expense associated with obtaining CDR data or what have you. Alltel will certainly argue that this isn't 100% accurate, that it does fail to take into account certain things. There is some truth to that. However, the POI methodology is proposed by Alltel is essentially at the opposite end of the spectrum from what's been proposed in this particular case. And when one looks at the POI methodology, one realizes the fallacy in it and that it simply cannot be applicable here in South Dakota, because it assumes that the location of the wireless caller is static. In other words, it never changes, and that's certainly not going to be the case here. And ultimately, use of the POI method drives down the amount of inter-MTA traffic and essentially leaves this in a position where the petitioners are not appropriately compensated for inter-MTA traffic. And I think the briefs likely do a better job than I just did of pointing out the differences between those particular methodologies and why the telephone numbers method is ultimately better. One of the other arguments that has been advanced by Alltel in this particular case is that the compensation for the inter-MTA traffic should be symmetrical. In other words, Alltel should get to offset or net the inter-MTA factor for that traffic terminated to the petitioners by whatever inter-MTA traffic might be terminated to it. This is not a new argument by Alltel, but it is one that I cannot find has a tremendous amount of precedent in any other agreements before other commissioners or has been explored by any cases. In this particular matter, we would submit to you that a net approach with regard to the inter-MTA factor isn't appropriate. As an initial matter, any inter-MTA traffic likely terminated to Alltel is de minimis at best, because most of the time the wireless caller is going to be calling from his or her initial subscriber area. And while there may be some instances where they doesn't, I would submit that that likely cancels out at the end of the day. If I travel to Pierre, there's likely someone from Pierre in Sioux Falls. So that likely cancels out, and ultimately the traffic is likely de minimis. Again, to the extent that any of that traffic could be characterized as long distance, that will then be routed to an inter-exchange carrier, and again, there would be no inter-MTA distinction in that particular case. of utmost significance, I think, when looking at whether there should be a netting of the factor is that Alltel doesn't have access rates. It doesn't have a tariff on file with this commission. It doesn't have a tariff on file with the FCC. And as a wireless carrier, it certainly has not been given necessarily the discretion by the FCC to do that. But that's one of the reasons in this particular case why it's obviously beneficial for Alltel to take advantage of the petitioner's rates. But that's simply not what was essentially advocated by the FCC in its first report and order or what would be expected. The FCC has certainly employed its different standards when looking at the calls, how those should be compensated, and the likely scenarios in which NRMTA traffic is to occur. And when looking at the NRMTA issue as a whole, Alltel suggested to you at the conclusion of the hearing that intra-MTA traffic is terminated no differently than intra-MTA traffic and should therefore not be dealt with or compensated any differently. Again, that's an argument that may have some appeal on its face, but it runs contrary to the FCC's rules and, again, the orders, because the FCC has effectively employed different costing standards for different types of traffic. And those are the rules that the FCC has promulgated with respect to this traffic, and those are the rules which the petitioners in this particular case have followed. I think what another of the significant issues advanced by Alltel at the time of the hearing was the case of Beresford when it comes to inter-MTA traffic. And there's no two ways about it. Beresford does present a rather challenging issue when it comes to inter-MTA traffic because of the location of the MTA boundaries. What Alltel suggested was that this commission take, I believe, what it termed a common sense approach when it came to Beresford. The problem with that, again, is it's a slippery slope type of argument. Again, the FCC has articulated specific costing standards for specific types of traffic. And while it may not have accounted for this type of a geographic anomaly, ultimately, if that needs to be changed, that's something that needs to be done before the FCC, because the rules that it has articulated for the compensation of that traffic and how it is defined in inter-MTA call allow for Beresford to recover the costs associated with those inter-MTA calls. And to a certain extent, by essentially punishing Beresford for the geographical location of the MTA boundaries in this particular case would be much like punishing Santel or another carrier for not being closer to an MTA boundary. The FCC recognizes the MTA boundaries, it recognizes the type of call, and it provides for the appropriate compensation of that. And the petitioners would submit that the study that has been proposed by Mr. Thompson in this particular case takes into account all of these various factors. There are certainly things that could be redone or updated at this point in time, but the analysis and the basic theories employed in that analysis are sound and are certainly appropriate to address the issues that are currently before this commission with regard to the treatment of the NRMTA traffic. And as I previously indicated, this is a rather notorious issue between these two parties, and it's something where in the past agreements have called for the inter-MTA factor to be adjusted or for a cost study to be, a study to be performed to allow for readjusting that factor. While that might take into account changes in networks, changes in subscribers, it's not something that the petitioners recommend in this particular case because it's something that has proven to be ineffective in the relationship between these particular parties and something which has spawned significant dispute. And so therefore the petitioners have proposed particular inter-MTA use percentages that they would request that this commission adopt for the life of the interconnection agreement, which is at issue in this particular case. With respect to the last issues that are before this commission, issue 3, which is what is the appropriate manner by which the minutes of use of intra-MTA traffic terminated by the parties should be calculated and billed. That applies to only two of the companies remaining, specifically McCook and Santel. And what Altel has proposed is that they use essentially a percentage factor. And what the petitioners have proposed in this particular case is that they should not be obligated to perform Altel's billing function. They are able to measure Altel's traffic and to bill Altel for it accordingly, and that is certainly what should be done. Altel is a company with significant financial resources, certainly more so than the petitioners in this particular case. And because of that, they certainly have available to them the means to determine and bill their own traffic to the petitioners in this particular case. Additionally, as a potential compromise, what could be done would be to provide Altel with the information itself with regard to the calls that are in fact terminated to these companies, so then that Altel could bill. Because these companies can ultimately do it, and therefore Altel should also be required to fulfill its billing obligations and should not be allowed to unilaterally force upon the petitioners in this particular case a reciprocal compensation factor that simply doesn't comport with reality and, again, is subject to the whims of negotiation as opposed to the ultimate amount of traffic that's actually exchanged between these two parties. With respect to the remaining two issues, the second to last one has to deal with the definitions that should be applied to inter and intra MTA traffic. And on these two issues, I'll be brief because I think the briefs themselves discuss this as well as the testimony. The definitions that have been proposed by the petitioners comport with the methods by which they have proposed this traffic should be billed. And given the magnitude of the issues before this commission with regard to the compensation of intra-MTA traffic and the compensation of inter-MTA traffic, the definitions need to reflect how that traffic should be treated and what one does to effectively define that type of traffic. That is what the petitioners have done in advancing the definitions that they have proposed in their particular agreement, and would submit to this commission that if the parties are to have an agreement as to how the traffic should ultimately be compensated, the petitioner's definitions with respect to the two types of traffic need to be adopted by this commission. The final issue, which would be issue 7, is one that we've been back and forth on a few times because initially it was one raised by Altel, which is which party can initiate a direct interconnection request. And it's something that after having submitted the final round of testimony, we thought we might actually have that resolved. However, then at the time of hearing, it became apparent again that this argument was evolving, so to speak, when it came to how this was to be interpreted. And ultimately, the issue currently before the court is if there is a direct interconnection between any of the petitioners and Altel, what are those points of direct interconnection that should be included as an appendix to the ultimate interconnection agreement? Altel has submitted a series of proposed points of interconnection, as have the petitioners. And the significant bone of contention with respect to this issue is whether the petitioners should be obligated to meet Altel in the event of a direct interconnection request at Altel's MFC. It's not appropriate. That's not something that was initially discussed with Altel at the time of the negotiations in this matter. It is a more burdensome obligation on the petitioners in this case. Rather, what the petitioners proposed was that if there were to be direct points of interconnection, those should be to the exchange boundaries of the exchanges at issue for the petitioners. Well, we certainly don't expect every single one of them. That is far more viable and practicable for these particular companies than it is to require that the petitioners meet at some point outside of their boundaries. And it all tells MSC or at other locations that are effectively unilaterally dictated by Alltel. So on that particular issue, we would ask the commission to adopt and to clarify the obligations of the petitioners when it would come to any sort of direct interconnection actually being achieved between Alltel and the particular petitioners. That would effectively conclude my argument at this point in time. We certainly thank the commission for its patience throughout the pendency of this proceeding. We certainly recognize that there are a number of highly complicated and technical issues that sometimes through our best efforts aren't maybe phrased in the most clear way possible. And if there are questions that the commission has in its mind or any reservations about the positions that have been advanced by the petitioners, I'm certainly more than willing to answer any of those questions. Otherwise, I think with respect to the findings and conclusions that this commission is required to produce under the FCC rules, there is ample evidence in the record to support findings that are in favor of the positions ultimately advanced by the petitioners. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Moore. Any questions by commissioners? Okay. We'll hear from Mr. Wazorek first, and then we'll move on to questions from commissioners and staff. Alltel.
Thank you, Commissioner. Talbot Wazorek of Anderson Palmer for Alltel Communications. I appreciate being here today, but it's kind of like a football team going to Nebraska. The Nebraska fans always kind of fill the stadium. So I want to address these issues, and I want to kind of get to the meat of the issues, which is really issue one and probably issue two. But I'd like to clear up first, I think, what appears to be some misunderstanding as to issue seven, which is the Direct Connects employees. Alltel's position is the POI or point of interconnects recommended under issue 7 is a unilateral request, which means we are not saying that we can require the RLX to come to our switch. What we are saying is they unilaterally can come to our switch. If you look at our, and I thought our brief was clear on this, but if you look at the brief, what our position is, we have four points that we should unilaterally be able to go to that are essentially all on what we believe to be the RLEC network, or any other mutually agreeable locations, one of them. But RLEC meet points, we think we should be able to go to those meet points, and RLEC switches or end offices, we should be able to go to those RLEC end offices unilaterally. The RLEC, if they want to directly connect with us, of course, we can mutually agree at any location, but they can certainly direct connect with us unilaterally, their choice, at the SDM tandem switch, at the Quest tandem switch, and at our switch. So I'm not, it's not Alltel's position that we can force them to come to our switch. Those are unilateral determinations that can be made either. Alltel's got four choices unilaterally they can hook into, and the RLX have four choices they can unilaterally come to us. And, you know, the fourth choice is always any mutually agreeable location. That doesn't mean, you know, if RTEC went to a meet point at SDN that the RLEC has with SDN, and the RLEC, RLEC can certainly approach Alltel at that point and say, hey, let's make this a two-way. But we can't force them to make them a two-way. That's their call. That's their call. So I wanted to clarify that issue. I want to, something that Ms. Moore said I think needs to be addressed right up front, though, on issue number one, and that's the reciprocal compensation issue. She has taken the position, or said, that we're, Alltel, is trying to make the RLX start at a level that doesn't even meet current need of the petitioners. And I guess I don't know what the current need of the petitioners is. I mean, obviously, the testimony is from Mr. Eklund. He is using a need, a forward-looking projection of transport demand that's so incredibly low, it's like less than one-tenth of the network that Mr. Weber designed. Mr. Weber then gets up and says, oh, well, crates, we're way beyond that need already. He says, we, you know, these companies are all pretty much surpassing or approaching an OC48. So we need the bigger network, the OC192. Well, you can't, simply you cannot have it both ways. You cannot come into this commission and say, look, commission, figure out what to bill these guys on per minute charges by using this minuscule forward-looking demand. Less than one-tenth of the network that we're demanding that you charge them for. Far less than one-tenth, in fact. And then have the engineer come in and say, well, you could use an OC12 to meet that demand. And then come in here and say, oh, you know, but we need the OC192 for the forward-looking demand. I mean, it is just incomprehensible, and I think it's Mr. Eklund borders on intellectual dishonesty when he's in front of this commission. You know, what is his analysis when under questions, well, Mr. Eklund, where'd you come up with this? All this information was provided from Narlex. When I asked Mr. Weber, he goes, I don't know where he got that because the demands, well, I'm sorry, I'll slow down. I get emotional sometimes. When he says, well, got it from the Narlex. Mr. Weber, though, who's the engineer working with them, says, well, their demand's way past that already. So, which is it? And Altel doesn't know. Mr. Eklund, how come you didn't project forward-looking demand for voice traffic? How come you used 2006? It's too hard to project forward-looking demand. But you agree voice traffic's going down, don't you, Mr. Eklund? Oh, yeah, voice traffic's going down. And broadband's going up. Oh, yeah, broadband's going up. And the only reason you need the big networks is broadband. Oh, yeah. But it's just too hard to project forward-looking demand. He didn't look at, I don't know where he got his demand. I don't know what he looked at. But I think it's clear on the record that his demand that he uses to calculate the recip comp is inadequate, not factually correct, and by the Arlex own engineers is rebutted. So what did Altel do? We didn't come in here and say, oh, make them use a network just for us, just for our traffic, as this commission's supposedly being told. What we said is, oh, we don't know where their demand is, but here's what the commission could do. The commission could, and we did a graph exhibit of that, Altel 12, here in Exhibit 12, and we laid that out for the commission. And what we said was, look, if you actually assume that Eklund's demand is correct, which Mr. Weber says is not, but if you actually assume that Mr. Eklund's demand is correct and assume 20% growth over 10 years in the life of these networks for somewhere between 7 and 10 years, you will not even approach the size of an OC48. So base the cost on an OC48, not an OC192. On the flip side, we said, well, if you want to use the OC192, then our position is you have to project or assume demand that justifies an OC192. And that should be somewhere between 60 and 65% of that capacity. That's what we've asked the commission to do. We've asked them to be realistic on the network being built. Interesting enough, in the briefs, the initial brief, I did not cite the MCI case, which comes, I believe, out of one of the southern circuits. It was cited by Darlex. But when I looked at the case, it was an interesting case because it talks about, look, you cannot claim an efficient lowest cost network when you set a network, and this was on Unis, but the Telerik applies to Unis too, same test. And they said, when you set when you start putting in loops with costs that vastly outstrip their utility, in a sense, the court said, look, who would build this network to service 1/20th of that demand? Nobody would. If you had to build it for yourself, nobody would build that network. So, you know, that's not a realistic forward-looking economic analysis. And the same thing here on the network that's being built, on a transport methodology, is if Eklund's demand is to be believed, nobody would build that network, period. So I'm not asking them they can build whatever they want, whatever they can make their customers pay for. But they can't make Alltel pay for them to build some dark fiber that's never going to see use. What the rules require is an efficient network, not an overbuilt network. Now, they can come back in and say, well, maybe they need that one network, fine. But then your demand in the formula has to reflect that. And so we did the analysis, and it's throughout the briefs, and it's contained in the hearing exhibit one where we did samples by Mr. Conwell, where he walked through that transport component. And so it is not Alltel's position that we're trying to make them build a network that only satisfies us. We're saying you have to cost that network, and if you're going to cost and build a network for 192, then you need traffic to justify it. And if your network at a size of OC48 can provide for the demand that you want to divide by for the next 10 years with 20% growth, then you have to use the lower network, the cost of the lower network. It's laid out in the testimony, and I think Ms. Morris is correct, is that there's a lot of detail running around here and a lot of analysis. I think the second part of the ReCIPCOM, which is switching termination component, there's a lot of testimony on that as to what was usage sensitive and what wasn't. The difficulty that the RLX had in meeting their burden here is that Mr. Weber admits that a bunch of costs they included are not necessary to terminate Alltel traffic, that these are non-usage-sensitive costs, essentially. And there's a lot of discussion over usage-sensitive, non-usage-sensitive. But the way that the FCC has looked at it and has examined in the brief is there's this getting started cost. What's the getting started cost? If you had to just service your own clientele as an RLX, and those costs were incurred, and if Alltel comes along and rides over the top, does that increase the cost? Certainly there's a transport component. Alltel's testified that there are certain switching components dealing with switching and termination that are cost sensitive. But there's a number of items, such as the switch itself, that is not cost sensitive. While Mr. Weber wouldn't admit the switch itself is not cost sensitive, he admitted that quite a bit of the components of the switch are not cost sensitive. We're not even used in the termination of calls. The cost didn't increase with additional calls. And those items should not be considered. The apartment analogy might catch somebody's flavor, but we're not talking about apartments here. We're talking about what the rules require. We're talking about what is occurring. And the analysis is really, and the cost usage analysis really arrives out of the following fundamentals. If you have something, and to use a component of your network, whether it be the actual switch, costs you nothing additional, but then you can actually charge for the transport. Economically, why wouldn't you let somebody use that switch, not charge them for the switching, so you can charge them for the transport, rather than say, I'm not going to charge you for it, can't use my system. And that's the analysis you go through. It's the drive to zero on the internet. There's a lot of items on the internet that people used to charge for. They don't charge for any now because they pick up the revenue in another way because they build traffic coming through. It's the same analysis, economic analysis here. I don't charge for my switch because there's no incremental cost. There's no additional cost for that switch component. I have to lay out whatever I have to lay out for that switch component to buy it. That's what I need just to do my business. So if Alltel comes along and I have something usage sensitive and I can charge them for the usage sensitive components, it's still a better economic analysis because I'm making money on those other things that they're trafficking over that are usage sensitive. And so we've been, I'm not going to go through the entire list of everything that we argued was usage sensitive. Essentially, it's most of the switch. And that switch cost should be thrown out. And this makes a big difference. The transports makes a big difference. The termination makes a difference. When we did the analysis, as is laid out in the brief, while Mr. Conwell could not do a full analysis because there were some holes in a couple of the companies, we calculated the final recip comp rate should be about 0.6 cents for these companies. And the commission can either, our recommendation to the commission at the close of our briefs was, look, the commission, you can either adopt that rate, which we thought was on the high end, or this commission could say, look, Alltel's position on what's cost sensitive on switch, we agree with them on this, this, and this. One of the problems we're running into is some of those items weren't broken out for costing. So we're going to throw those out. Alltel's position on transport makes sense. Calculate this using an OC48 network and rerun your cost study and bring those numbers back to us. And if the commission decides to go that route, asking them to correct their study, we had asked that we have some review of that so when we know that the inputs are properly placed in and that the changes are made. And I think really those are the only, on the transport issue, I think really those are the only options in the law the commission has. When you have in the record the ARLEC's own witnesses, the ARLEC's engineer, saying, hey, our demand's a lot more than what Eklund's using, I think you cannot adopt the ARLEC's. At that point, the law will not allow you to adopt the ARLEC's position. How can you say it's a forward-looking analysis, a forward-looking examination of the traffic, when their own engineer says, we are way beyond that already? Ms. Moore kind of alluded to it, but it was really Mr. Eklund that tried to cop out of it. Well, you know, it's a 2007 study. I used 2006 numbers, and you know, but nobody believes that demand went from less than an OC12 to over an OC48 in a year's time for these companies. And giving Mr. Eklund the benefit of the doubt, maybe he just didn't get the right numbers. But clearly, the right numbers on demand were not used to figure your transport. Clearly, the evidence shows the right numbers on demand were not used in the flex study. And given that record, I think the commission's limited in its approach. You cannot adopt the flex study as it sits today. I'd like to talk then about the next couple of issues, and that's the inter-MTA issue. And Mr. Hansen would recall, or Commissioner Hansen would recall, that this issue has been hard fought more than once in front of this commission. There's a tendency by the ARLEC to dismiss the point of methodology, though their witnesses acknowledge that this commission could adopt the point methodology. And I believe, and Alltel thinks, that the POI methodology just makes a lot of sense for a couple of reasons. One of them being, look, if you're charging long-distance rates, but the calls are not being delivered that way, why are you charging long-distance rates? I mean, it's a cost-causer analysis. If I'm a wireless company and I come to this state and I just want to interconnect in Sioux Falls and I want traffic to be delivered to the ARLEC some other way, well, then either I'm going to have to cooperate with a long-distance carrier, SDN, or somebody else, and I'm going to be paying bigger rates. If I want to take a direct connect out to a company, directly to a company, I'm encouraged to do that if the POI then is used to calculate the inter-MTA, because I'm incurring the cost to take those calls all the way there. So it encourages build-out. It encourages that the cost causer pays to bring that call. It encourages rewarding companies to build out into this area. The other thing it avoids is just a arbitrage potential situation. And that is, if I'm going to be paying in-state long distance as a company, as a wireless company coming into this state for inter-MTA calls, well, maybe I shouldn't build out my system. Maybe I should just have Quest carry all my traffic under an agreement of long distance, and then I don't have to pay that rate. And so what you do is people won't be making judgments on efficiency of networks. They'll be making judgment on these arbitrary lines that were drawn by the federal government for a wholly different purpose, these major trade areas, and not for what makes sense. I mean, Beresford's the perfect example. Why is Beresford's inter-MTA rate so high? Because the tower in Beresford is on one side of the road and the switch is on the other. So does that make sense then if Alltel's going to get hit for long-distance calls, for calls coming from Beresford, from one house on the road to the other house on the road, or from somebody actually who's standing right outside the building that has a switch but calls and starts in that tower? Does that make sense for Alltel to shut that tower down and maybe move a tower someplace else? I mean, do we really want to be driving companies to make determinations on locations of infrastructure on lines drawn by, I believe, the Commerce Department years ago to set major trade areas? The POI method allows the companies a way to say, look, I'll build out to that because that'll make my network more efficient. I'll avoid the whole hassle of inter-MTA calls, and the POI should be used. If the commission should decide not to adopt a POI methodology, I don't believe you can adopt the RLX study. Nobody ever, I believe, takes the position that a study is 100% perfect. All studies miss a call here and there. But it's legitimate, and Alltel's position is legitimate, to say that the RLX numbers are seriously flawed. Why are they seriously flawed? Well, for one reason, they didn't do the analysis on Alltel. The analysis that was performed was 4 to 5 years old, and it was conducted on Western Wireless. As the testimony reflected, there's been substantial changes from when Western Wireless was bought by Alltel. They shut down some switches. They spun one switch off in Nebraska. They stopped using it. They spun a switch off up in Minnesota. So that changed the whole flow of traffic. All the Nebraska calls that were counted to sit the factor were now being delivered a wholly different way through a long-distance carrier. And Mr. Davis admitted that the RLX are not seeking to have the calls paid for by a long-distance carrier and paid for by Alltel. So those factors become, well, just unreliable at this point. And the thing that I've never been really able to figure out here is the RLX have all the ability to do that test again. But when they came to do this arbitration, they didn't bother to do it again. They simply relied on data that was done on a different company. And so you can't use their factors. They're just not substantiated, not reliable, and not even done for Alltel. One of the exhibits attached to one of the hearing exhibits I attached to the brief was the inter-MTA factor issue summary. And it gave the analysis between the different POI study, the 2004 SS7 study, the SS7 study adjusted, and what Alltel did there is they looked at that SS7 study from 2004 and said, well, these calls are now routed a whole different way, so they wouldn't have been caught in the old study, and adjusted those numbers. And then we have an estimated set off based on Land Mobile. Now, Ms. Moore takes the position that we shouldn't get a set off for Land Mobile. And on the inter-MTA, it's this commission's, within this commission authority to give us that set off, and I would ask that you give that set off for the following reason. Obviously, those calls are coming back. Those types of calls are coming back. The ability to grant a set off to Alltel makes sense. Why should a call going one way be treated as an inter-MTA call, but a call going another way not be treated as an inter-MTA call? So, with that, I recommend that the commission review the exhibit for the actual numbers, the final numbers, rather than me try to go through all the numbers. On Beresford, Beresford is an interesting case. It's an aberration. The request that Alltel seeks is, if you do not use the ploy study, that the Beresford number should be adjusted, that Beresford rated numbers should not be treated as long distance. We shouldn't be charged long distance for Beresford rated numbers. Again, we have the aberration because Beresford calls are turned into long distance calls just by the location of the tower versus the switch. On rates, on inter-MTA rates, our brief addresses rates fairly extensively. One of the problems we have with the rates is the RLECs want to use their interstate long distance rate. However, if you look at the tariff, it doesn't apply in this situation. The other difficulty that you have under the current unified rate for long distance is there's no components broken out. So essentially, we're getting charged for carrying calls from Sioux, with an assumption that RLECs have to carry the calls from Sioux Falls. So, if the commission is going to set a rate, we believe the interstate rate would be appropriate because you can break out the components of the interstate rate for how the call is actually delivered. The, on the factor billing issue, the difficulty with the factor billing issue in our brief addresses this, is that Alltel cannot get the records for a lot of calls coming back from the RLECs because the RLECs route them through long-distance carriers. We'd be entitled to charge for those inter-MTA calls, but we won't even know they're coming from the RLEC because they're being routed through a long-distance carrier. And we did a factor billing analysis. The RLECs historically used factor billing with Alltel. They have it in other agreements. This is for McCook and for Santel. The RLECs didn't object to the factors that we came up with. The McCook factor was 67.33 and the Santel factor was 66.34. And to allow Alltel to be reimbursed for terminating those calls, intra-MTA calls, would request the commission allow factor billing. Frankly, as to the issue 6, the MTA definition, as I said in my brief, that definition issue kind of gets taken care of based on how you deal with issue number 2. And if you set the factors, the rates, and everything for the course of the agreement, arguing over what the exact definition really becomes almost meaningless. So we believe our definition is adequate, but in the end, when you resolve all the issues for under issue number 2, it kind of resolves that issue number 6. So with that, I'm talking slower now, so Sherry's getting it down. And I don't know if you want rebuttal or go straight to questions. Okay. For questions, if the commission wants, I can move over there so we just have two mics and we're not jumping back and forth.
That's a good idea. Let's move to rebuttal and then we'll move on to questions.
I apologize if I bounce around a little bit with my notes. Thank you, Commission. Mr. Wazorek indicated in his comments that the issues in front of this commission do engender some emotion on behalf of both of the parties, and that's because these issues are very significant, they're very involved, they're very complicated, and they have far-reaching effects when it comes to how the petitioners in this case are compensated. And so it is easy to get emotional, and it's also somewhat difficult, too, at times, to listen to an argument that the ARLAC's witnesses in this particular case sat before this commission and were not entirely forthcoming or were not honest in their testimony. And again, I think that's one of the fundamental distinctions between the positions of these two parties, which is that one cannot isolate Mr. Weber's testimony from Mr. Eplin's. They are in no way contrary to one another. And I think that Mr. Wozorek's point with regard to the demand clearly illustrates that. I believe the question that was posed to Mr. Weber at the time of the hearing in regard to capacity and what type of capacity these petitioners currently need was whether an OC-48 could handle the switched traffic, the voice traffic that these petitioners currently have. And I believe Mr. Weber did, in fact, indicate that, yes, it could perhaps do that. But what that does is it ignores all other demand. It ignores the total demand that is to be taken into consideration when looking at the FLEC model in this particular case. And so what we end up having is ultimately an apples versus oranges discussion, because Mr. Weber can't build a network solely for wireless traffic, solely for broadband traffic, solely for cable. You simply can't do that. This is one network that needs to be designed to account for the current needs and the current capacity. And I believe Mr. Wozorek told you that no one would ever build this particular network. Well, 3 out of the 5 companies in this particular case has, which certainly belies that particular argument. And ultimately, again, when you look at the FLEC model, what Mr. Eplin did was to take a look at what Mr. Weber deployed as far as this efficient network that was the most cost-effective. And he excluded non-usage sensitive costs. He excluded other costs. He also employed the PATH method. And when Mr. Wozorek was essentially ignoring that other demand category that exists beyond the voice, that PATH method effectively takes out the broadband costs. And that is the model that's been employed by the petitioners, in this particular case. And that's why it is far more effective and ultimately allocating out the particular costs than the bandwidth method or the DS1 equivalency method that has been proposed by Alltel here. Mr. Wozorek also commented on the use of the demand. And if one looks at Mr. Eklund's testimony, he does clearly indicate that he used 2006 demand and then made forward-looking assumptions based upon this demand. If one looks at the trends that are currently and readily apparent in the industry, the trend is that wireless traffic is on the rise and other types of traffic are on the way down. So if you look towards the future, then that means more of the network is going to be used for wireless traffic. So by using the 2006 demand and by effectively making forward-looking projections, as Mr. Eplin did, that ultimately is a far more conservative approach and really gives the benefit of the doubt to Alltel, I'm sure. I'm sure they'll disagree with me on that point under these particular circumstances. So with respect to the demand, again, the argument that it's not forward-looking, that it doesn't take into account current trends, that's simply a red herring argument that has been advanced by Alltel in this particular case. Mr. Wozorek also talked with you about the switch, and he referred to these getting started costs. And I believe what he's relying on in that particular instance is an arbitration decision out of Virginia. And that decision in and of itself is strange, in my opinion, because ultimately what seems to have happened there is that the Virginia Commission delegated its own authority to the FCC to preside over an arbitration proceeding between, I believe it was Verizon of Virginia, and another particular party. And in that case, it was Verizon of Virginia who was seeking to establish rates to bill the other party, who said that we will propose that the switch is a getting started cost. The petitioners in this case have never proposed that the switch be viewed in that manner. There is no evidence in the record which would allow for Alltel to support an argument that that switch is a getting started cost, and that Virginia discussion or that Virginia arbitration decision simply isn't instructive for this commission, given some of the admissions made by the parties and introduced into evidence by those parties. Those facts aren't present in this record for this commission to operate off of, and therefore you must look at the record that is currently before the commission with respect to the testimony of Mr. Weber and Ms. Vanacek. And the one thing, if you do look at that Virginia decision, which I would encourage you to do because it does show the fallacy in Alltel's argument here, is that if one looks at that decision, the FCC did note that the FCC rules state that costs can be recovered on a fixed rate or a variable rate. The FCC gave that discretion. This commission has that discretion. In the Virginia case, they didn't have that discretion because the party that was advancing the rates and applying for approval for those rates was the one who said the switch should be a fixed cost. The petitioners in this case haven't done so, and therefore that's not an appropriate argument. Mr. Wazurek also talked with you about rerunning the cost study using a series of capped costs, and I think that illustrates another fundamental distinction between the petitioner's argument and Alltel's argument. The procedural posture of this case is different in that the negotiations were conducted jointly and the hearing itself was consolidated, but you have four different companies before you proposing different rates. The FLEC model isn't a comparative model. It takes into consideration the unique economic realities facing each one of these companies. And so, therefore, to say, well, we like McCook's factor, or it appears to be more reasonable than West River's factor, or than Santel's factor, that's not appropriate because that is not reflective of each of these companies' respective costs. And again, the FLEC model is intended to be qualitative and quantitative and not comparative. And also, Alltel should not be given a benefit simply because of the procedural posture and the consolidated nature of this particular case. I think if one looks again at the distinction between the parties on how TELRIC is to be applied, it is important to look at what's currently going on before the FCC. And one of the proposed orders that was recently handed down by Commissioner Martin is really clear evidence that Alltel's proposed analysis in this case does not comport with the current status of the law as articulated by the FCC. And that particular proposed order is the order on remand and report and order and further notice of proposed rulemaking that they were seeking comment on. And specifically, Exhibit A attached thereto clearly articulates that the entire cost of the switch is recoverable, and that is actually the principle that has been adopted by the FCC. So the fact that the FCC is now debating some of these things and looking for comment on some of these things clearly illustrates that what Alltel is currently advancing here today isn't the current state of the law, that the current state of the law is TELRIC. That's what's been applied in this case, and that's what should be applied in this case. With respect to the interim TA factor, Mr. Wazurek talked about the POI method as being the more accurate method. The problem with that argument is that given the history between these two cases, or between these parties in this particular case, is that Alltel's focus has always been on negotiation and upon not using actual numbers, actual traffic to come up with the ultimate interim TA factor. And from that perspective, the factors that have been proposed have never been an accurate reflection of what is ultimately the interim TA traffic at issue with these petitioners. The state boundaries are what they are. The MTA boundaries are what they are. And because of that, the POI method is inaccurate, and this commission has the rules before it that had been set forth by the FCC with regard to the treatment of those calls and with regard to the compensation of those calls. And the POI method at the end of the day does exactly what Alltel would like it to do, which is to drive down that inter-MTA factor to virtually zero. With respect to the symmetrical compensation argument, I think this is another area where Alltel is effectively mixing apples and oranges in its argument, because symmetrical compensation, if one looks at the rules, is to apply to local traffic and the 251 obligations. It does not apply to access traffic. So what, again, they're trying to do here is to apply the rules for local traffic to access traffic. And again, if one looks at the current state of the discussions before the FCC, and some of the discussion does in fact relate to that, it again shows you that Alltel's current argument before this commission does not comport with the current status of the law, and that the methodology in this particular case that was employed by the petitioners and that has been advocated as being essentially a one-way methodology is what's ultimately appropriate. That study can always change. It likely always will change. There are factors that it can always be taken into account, but the ultimate methodology is sound. And what has been done in this particular case is to put that before you to show you that that is in fact sound and to acknowledge that certainly there are issues, but those are issues that can be addressed, that can be resolved, and do not ultimately undermine the end validity of that particular study. And I believe that's all I have at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mazur? I'm sorry. I just wanted you guys to go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth.
Questions
from staff or commissioners?
Go ahead, you want to start?
Let's start in with the switch a little bit. Pardon my voice. Mr. Wazorek, you referred to Alltel 12. And in Alltel 12...
Before we get... I'm sorry to interrupt you, Commissioner. I just want to make sure if we're talking about confidential that we go off, and if the parties could... I think the parties need to be helpful in this matter and say if the commissioners are going to, or any of us are asking any questions that you consider confidential. I'm sorry.
I think the point is very well taken. I was going to speak in generalities that I don't think would require, at least for this question, a movement into closed session. But that being said, if I overstep the bounds, please say something. In any case, with Alltel 12, Alltel's indicated two lines, one that would be the capacity of a 192 and a second line that indicated the capacity of a 48. Also plotted on this chart is what Alltel described in their brief as, you know, a 10% annual growth or a 20% annual growth. At least during the hearing, Mr. Wazorek, I also charted what Mr. Weber had indicated he thought was the possible multimedia demand. And that line went past the OC 48 line. And you've made arguments a number of times that, well, they say that their demand basically legitimizes a 192, but the numbers they've actually given us wouldn't. Given the fact that under one scenario 48 might be appropriate, but under another usage scenario 192 would be appropriate, doesn't that mean that a switch is usage sensitive?
First, a couple things. Alltel 12 is a transport component, and does not intend to address the switching component of the reciprocomp. As to the difference between the transport, and I don't have the one that has those notes, and I want to make this clear to the commission. I did not, and I didn't mean to intend if I did that I thought Mr. Weber had misspoke or potentially misled this commission. I think the questioning that, as I recall it, to Conwell had to do with capacity issues. See, Weber testifies, and in the transcript at page 174, he says, for many of these companies, they're exceeding OC-48 today. And he then says specifically one company in 2001, they put in an OC-48. So what Weber or what Conwell is trying to talk about is, you know, what's driving this? If you look back at the, and I believe I have the exhibit handy, at another Conwell exhibit. Bear with me a moment. There, in Conwell, he does an exhibit that says, look, when we're talking about capacity and we're talking about demand, you're supposed to be looking at total demand, not just voice traffic. Now, so when they're throwing out the Flex study, what the Flex study does then is he takes the voice demand and segments that off and then allocates to that voice demand, and that gets into that whole path method that we think it should be a DS1 equivalent method, because he counts every voice traffic line as one path. That's what Eklund does. Conwell's position and Altel's position is, look, you should do a DS1 equivalent because DS1s are what's introduced at switch level. And so what Conwell or what the Flex study does is they say, okay, here's what part of this traffic or here's what part of this demand is voice demand. And then you take that voice demand and you say, here's how many minutes of that voice demand. You take that voice demand, and voice demand is, he comes up with like 90% because of his path method. Though, our argument should almost be reversed down to 10 because there's multiple DS1s for other services. And you take that voice demand, if it's 90% of what the paths, he says, then you take that 90%, you take 90% of the cost, and that's the voice cost, and then you divide it by the minutes of use through a year, and that's what you charge per minute. And so that's where you get these exponentially growths on his analysis on the transport part, because number one, if you under project demand, total demand, meaning all applications, and then say, first of all, say it's 200 paths, and then over project using the path method, the portion that is voice, you just every time you do that equation, you just keep increasing the amount voice is paying to carry that network. If the need for the network and the need for the growth is coming from broadband applications, so under Altel 12, we took their total demand, not just what he allocates to voice traffic, and then on 20% growth, calculate it, given what Eklund provided. Now, the rub that you get and the rub that Conwell had here is that Weber's saying, look, these guys are already in their demand for total demand exceeding OC-48s. But that's not total demand just for voice traffic. I mean, nobody's out there saying you need OC-48s to carry voice traffic for Santel. That's for all your services. And so out of that total demand, you break up voice traffic. Eklund uses the voice traffic, and he uses the path methods because that out of, the analysis was done on one of the companies, and what the difference was is under the path method, and I'm going to do this off the top of my head for one of the companies, Eklund came up with like 1,200 paths, 1,100 of them being voice and 100 being the other, 1,100 being DSOs and 100 being these other DS1s out there doing other services. And then he takes that voice traffic off. But he calculates the total demand over the 1,200 number. Our argument, and what makes more practical sense, is the better way to allocate total cost is the DS1 equivalents, and then you divide total cost, you take that down to the voice traffic component, and you figure per minute based on that. And that's for the transport component.
Also on the switch, Altel in its brief argues for the getting started, to classify as getting started. You know, that was the Commission's Common Carrier Bureau wrote that order. I didn't see any notation, any other state commission taking that sort of approach.
There is some cites in Conwell's testimony to a California commission, and I believe a couple other commissions also. There's cites in the brief to the Eighth Circuit case on a UMI case that essentially said switch is just getting started. So there is other authority for that, you're correct, that was the common carrier, not the full FCC, that rendered that decision.
I'll pose the same question to Ms. Moore. Ms. Moore, arbitrations have gone on presumably in states all over the country. There were some citations to how other states handled switches, but maybe not as much as would be helpful to the Commission. Are you aware of other instances where states have allowed these switching costs?
It's a very good question, Commissioner, and the cases that are the best were the ones that were, in fact, cited. There are other cases which discuss it, but because of distinguishing facts in the record or because of the proposals made by the petitioners themselves, they wouldn't have necessarily been instructive to this commission because you would have been comparing a completely different set of beginning facts than what's before this particular commission.
Thanks, Ms. Moore. Mr. Wazorek, on, I think it's the reply brief, on page 10, he lays out a dichotomy that he says actually the RLECs have laid out. You probably remember that he says, in the first instance, either the RLEC network is overbuilt and therefore inefficient, or B, the RLEC network is built to handle much more demand that is created by voice traffic, but that demand is not included in the RLEC cost derivation. I'll admit that I find some attractiveness to that argument. Can you say anything that would dissuade me from that belief?
Sure, and I certainly don't mean to beat a dead horse by any stretch of the imagination, but I think that goes back to the fundamental distinction between the demand associated with switched traffic and the other demand that's out there that creates the total demand, which is what Telric requires the FLEC model to consider and what the rules require this commission to consider. And I think this is where some of the testimony offered by Mr. Eklund in his pre-filed testimony and at the time of the hearing would be instructive, because what he's saying is, yes, we look at total demand, and yes, we're looking at voice traffic over here, and yes, we understand that we've got other demand, and that the petitioners in this particular case aren't just building a network for Alltel, they're building a network that will provide services for their own end users and for other providers in addition to Alltel. Because of that, you have to look at the total demand. And when you go to the FLEC study is designed to remove those costs. And specifically the PATH method, as it's outlined by Mr. Eklund and as it's described, and he goes through some of the fallacies that he finds within Mr. Conwell's argument as far as how those costs are allocated. But what he's saying is that PATH method is to remove the cost of the dedicated facilities or the special access circuits from the total cost of the transport. And the reason why the PATH method ultimately better allocates the costs that are associated with that other demand is because the cost is ultimately driven by the distance that that path travels as opposed to the capacity of the path, which is the Alltel argument. And if you look at the DS1 and the DS3, they ultimately incur the same provisioning and maintenance and testing costs as does a DS0. So you get into this analogy where what the bandwidth method does, or the DS1 equivalency method proposed by Alltel, it takes out too much of those costs and it shifts those to other services. And then who pays for those services? And what ultimately that does then is that it shifts the costs associated with those services to the end users of the RLECs in this particular case. And the DS1 equivalency method takes out so much of the cost and would shift that to the end users who shouldn't have to bear that particular cost. So the problem is that the particular section to which you're referring is really that allocation of costs, who should bear them, where they should go. And that's where the PAP method comes in and does the best job at looking at the costs that are incurred in employing this network and not only providing voice service, but also providing those other services and ensuring that they are appropriately allocated to where they need to be in the FLEX study, and they are ultimately borne by the party that should share in those costs.
But Ms. Moore, in Mr. Wisorek's reply brief, he notes on page 11 that because the DS0s are only introduced at the DS1 level, there is no extra work in handling the DS0 or connecting a DS0. Given that, is the PAP method really properly allocating costs?
I think it is properly allocating the cost, because if you go through, Mr. Eklund employs an analysis in his pre-filed testimony. He looks at essentially the cost of the various circuits and how if you were to utilize that particular argument and if you follow through to fruition Mr. Conwell's argument, that you're actually going to end up with an exorbitant rate. So I think in theory that certainly has some appeal to it, but in practice when actually looking at the circuits, looking at the pads, looking at the costs associated with those, you quickly see how the costs aren't appropriately allocated. I admit on its face it certainly has some appeal, but when one actually gets down to looking at the circuits that are paths that are involved in this particular case and looking at the costs associated with those, the PAP method is ultimately a better allocation of costs because it's again driven by the distance and not the ultimate capacity as proposed by Mr. Conwell.
Do those exorbitant costs result even if the bandwidth method isn't used, but rather a 7-to-1 equivalency type method?
I think it could, because I think ultimately you're still employing an analysis that where the focus isn't on the path. It's on the bandwidth of that particular service, and so regardless of the ratio between the two, ultimately the costs still aren't being appropriately allocated or appropriately viewed.
And I don't know, Mr. Chairman, what's your pleasure? I mean, I can bounce around. I've got other questions. If you want to pause on a particular topic and take all commissioner questions on a topic at once, I can stop. Or if you want me to move to a different area, I can certainly do that.
No, actually, that's exactly what I was thinking. I have a couple questions related to
that. Yeah, go ahead.
This, your exhibit, Appendix 4, I think it's LTL Exhibit 12, the demand. You've got a 10% annual growth and a 20% annual growth.
20.
Okay. Where did that estimate come from?
Well, Conwell assumed that estimate simply to show an example of just for the commission's knowledge, the baseline investment exhibit is 9, is the one that I couldn't remember the number for earlier.
Okay.
And the reason Conwell did that was to say, look, if you actually use the demand they're projecting that they say exists in 2006, and you assume a 20% growth, which would be a pretty healthy growth, would this network size, the OC48, still be sufficient? And he did that simply because to illustrate how a much smaller network could handle. Well, and he was kind of forced in that position when you have Eklund saying, I can't estimate forward-looking demand. I'm going to just use 2006. So Conwell kind of de facto said, well, you know, if you assume in the future demand's going to be growing, as they say, broadband's growing, the voice traffic's falling off, let's see what kind of smaller network could be used. And that's, and so he came up with 20% as being more than reasonable for annual growth of demand.
Okay. I was just wondering, it didn't come from anything from 2000, from like growth that was incurred from 1998 to 2008, or the 20%, I guess I'm kind of, is that just a...
No, it was a percentage that, as I recall, he came up with as being a robust growth number,
okay,
given his experience in the industry. starting with their base number, just to illustrate to the commission that a much smaller network should be sufficient if that's the number you're going to use.
Okay. And you do feel that 20% growth would be accurate?
Well, I mean, as Ms. Morris said a number of times, there's a number of companies involved here. I think the general testimony throughout was that that they're all seeing voice drop off, mm-hmm. but they're all trying to lay out more broadband applications. So I'm not familiar with those companies individually to say where they're at with their growth rates. Obviously, that is a question Mr. Eklund could have asked.
Sure.
And actually projected growth rather than just use old growth, old numbers.
Okay. And that I guess, is where what I wanted to clarify in my mind. You can, Commissioner Hansen, any questions on this topic?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate both of you asking questions first, because I'm going through my notes attempting to compare what I would consider inconsistencies with previous information, and then trying to compare and come to some resolution from what the oral arguments were today. And I think that Mr. Wieczorek brought up some excellent points pertaining to, I will call it, the consistency of the arguments, and the I'm going to give Ms. Moore an opportunity to attempt to at least have a shot at rectifying that. But why would Mr. Weber and Mr. Eklund's estimates of demand differ so much?
They differ, Commissioner Hansen, because what Mr. Weber was doing was designing a network that would handle all types of traffic, and not only Alltel's traffic, but would also handle services for other users. He was essentially deploying a network that, if Santel were to call him tomorrow, Mr. Weber could fully implement. And he was taking the costs that were associated with that network, and he sat down with Mr. Eklund and provided that information to him. Mr. Eklund then went back to the Telerik standard and looked at the specific includable costs, as well as what the FCC, says should not be included. And one of the things in doing that is to ensure that the FLEC model employs an appropriate method to strip out those non-usage sensitive charges, that it employs a method by which to properly allocate costs among all demand, and to ensure that the costs that are left therein are associated with the costs associated with terminating an Alltel call. So if you look at what each of them did, they each had an end goal in mind. One was to develop the network. The other one was to look at the network that has been developed and to say, okay, what costs can be appropriately passed on to the users of that particular network, using ultimately what is in the FCC rules. And as we discussed earlier, Mr. Weber certainly did indicate that an OC48 might be appropriate in some instances to handle the current demand for switched traffic. So what Mr. Eklund's challenge was to provide a reasonable, essentially, look or take on what the demand is for voice services and also what the demand is for other services in addition to that, and try to best allocate those costs so that Alltel isn't paying for all the costs associated with broadband or with cable or the other services that these companies are providing to their subscribers. But the problem is, again, if one views those testimonies in isolation or essentially excludes them, what happens is that there is a somewhat appealing argument that, hey, Alltel shouldn't be required to pay for these sorts of expenses, But if we start removing them, rerunning the FLEX study, deciding that these networks are too big or too great or too expensive or gold-plated or what have you, where do those costs go with providing those services? What happens is too much, according to Altel's argument, is pulled out of the cost that the FCC has specifically indicated should be shared. And that's what then gets passed on to the end user customer, which certainly isn't appropriate. And again, this is where I think some of what's currently going on in front of the FCC with regard to the intercarrier compensation discussion is relevant and would help in that regard. Because again, what that's pointing out is this significant distinction between the TELRIC standard as it exists and how it's currently being applied in commissions across this country and how it has been interpreted by the FCC and what is this additional incremental cost. Because what is ultimately happening here is Altel is gaining traction by parsing out these infinitesimal portions of the network and saying, well, that shouldn't be here and that shouldn't be here and that shouldn't be here. And when one does that, you extract too many of the costs associated with the construction of this particular network. And that flies in the face of the TELRIC standard and the TELRIC calculation with regard to the term total. I have no idea if I even attempted to answer your question there, so I apologize if I got a little far afield, but I think that's the overarching framework that needs to be employed when looking at the testimonies, because there has to be a recognition that their end goals were different as far as what they were attempting to accomplish under the FCC rules.
Well, thank you. I did not mean for you to have to repeat a portion of what you had said previously, and I certainly would never fault you at giving an incomplete answer. I mean that in a friendly way. Should we... I struggle when we're looking at the size of the OC-192 and the capacity. Should we not be using an OC-48 for analysis purposes?
I don't believe you need to do that. And I think if you again look at the testimony of Mr. Weber and Mr. Eklund, you can reconcile those concerns. Because ultimately, you're looking at what many of these companies currently have to keep up with the demand for not only the voice-grade traffic, but also the other services. And one of the goals in building this network is looking to the future. And if you look at what Mr. Weber's testimony supports, is that the OC-12 is antiquated to a certain extent. The OC-48 is rapidly approaching that. And that what is happening is that not only the companies that are currently in front of you, but also similarly situated companies in other states that Mr. Weber constructs networks for, they are going to this OC-192 network or this larger network in order to handle current demand and also in order to look to the future. And there are specific cases that have been decided where it talks about and specifically here I'm referring to the AT&T Communications of Illinois versus the Illinois Bell Telephone Company case. It indicates that any sensible carrier builds more network capacity than can be used at the moment. That way, capacity will be available as additional customers demand service without awaiting for the arrival of new equipment, excavating streets to lay new wire, and so on. And when one again looks at Altel's argument, to a certain extent, it's a proposal with regard to constructing an inefficient network where we might have an OC-48 now, but in 2 years we may need to add another component to that. In 2 years after that, we may need to add another component to that, and that flies in the face of not only being the most efficient network, it also flies in the face of attempting to control the costs associated with that. And I think if one looks at the actual numbers associated with the OC-48 and the 192 and the costs associated with that, that may allay some of your fears with regard to the ultimate capacity argument.
But doesn't the, or rather does the OC-192 reflect the most efficient and the most cost-effective technology that's available?
I believe it does, yes. And that would be supported by Mr. Weber and Ms. Vanacek's testimony. And again, on the one hand, you've got the realities of constructing the network and the costs associated with doing so, and then the application of TELRIC to that, and with regard to the TELRIC standard of costs not being fixed, but being variable over the long run so as to recover as much of those costs as what is appropriate under the circumstances. And then what the FLEX study does is that if there is demand that isn't there, that is allocated out of the FLEX study with those non-usage sensitive charges.
Mr. Wieczorek, do you have any comments on the questions I asked and the answers I received?
Just a couple, first, I think we all have to be careful not to intermingle the components of ReCIPCOM. I do get a little nervous in the response you received where you're talking usage-sensitive switching and then just segueing into transport issues. Those are very different. They're all part of ReCIPCOM, but they're different and they're unique. So I think we have to be careful that what we're talking about. On the transport issue, the concern is this, and I go right back to what one of the opening things I said in my arguments, and that is, look, we're not telling you what network to build, but you can't justify an OC-192 network on the demand that you show in your FLEX study. And Altel 9 walks through that, where you have the voice trunks and the special circuits trunks, non-voice trunks, to figure out total demand. If your total demand is couple percentage points of the total capacity of an OC-192, according to Mr. Eklund, because he can't project forward-looking demand, then you can't justify the network size. Now, Altel said, look, we're not going to tell you what size to build, but if you're going to use that demand that Eklund uses, then you cannot justify the OC-192. If you take Mr. Weber at his word, which I don't have any reason not to, that all these guys are already kind of at the 48 level, and then you've got to appropriately allocate the demand. Now, what happens is, you know, do you change the numerator or do you change the denominator? But you got to do one. I mean, you can't reconcile the evidence not to change at least one of them. So either the network size is sized inefficiently if you use Eklund's demand, or if you use Weber's, what Weber says is today's demand, then you could justify the size of the network, but then what you're dividing the network over for costing has to be adjusted correctly. I'm not telling them to build a network just for voice traffic. I'm not telling them to build a network just for us. What I'm saying is the law doesn't allow the carriers to come in here and say, you know what, broadband's the wave of the future, so let's build a big network because we think we're going to use it. And then say, but the way we're going to pay for it is we're going to underestimate our demand, our existing demand, so we can jack the rate up on voice traffic. So, you know, build whatever you want, fairly charge me for it. So only charge me for an efficient network. If your demand's only this minuscule amount that Eklund represents, if the demand is what Weber says it truly is, then use that to divide the cost of your OC-192 network. That demand that's, you know, as much as 20 times greater than these for these carriers. And that's all I have, Commissioner, unless you have a follow-up.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Moore.
All right. Mr. Johnson?
One more question sort of related to this area. In Ms. Moore and in Mr. Conwell's testimony, there were some issues raised about specifically with regard to Kennebec and taxation and sort of the capital mix, the capital structure. It's a bit of a technical question, but it was raised in Alltel's brief, and so I wanted to give you an opportunity to respond.
If you'll bear with me, Commissioner, I'm just trying to find my own spot in that regard so that I can better address your question. I do recall that particular argument having been made with regard to the costs, and Kennebec appears to have been the whipping boy to a certain extent on many occasions when it comes to its costs by Mr. Conwell in this particular case. And again, I think this is where in looking at the FLEC model, where it's intended to incorporate each of these companies' unique costs and unique economic efficiencies. And I think what he was referring to there were the differences between deferred taxes and otherwise, and that's simply not the way in which Kennebec has economized its particular costs. That is permissible within the confines of the FLEC model and within TELRIC, and what Mr. Eklund did in essentially going through Kennebec's costs was to, again, put in what he considered to be includable and to take out what he did not consider to be consistent with TELRIC. So along those lines, he used the appropriate federal standards that are in place for tax, for how that tax is to be determined, for how those costs are ultimately to be categorized when it comes to the FLEC study. So what that FLEC model results is the unique nature of the costs that as they relate to Kennebec or as they relate to Santel or as they relate to McCook. And I apologize, I haven't found my spot yet here, but I think the brief does a better job of going through the unique nature of Kennebec and how what Mr. Conwell's argument does is it really doesn't take into account the fact that Kennebec is permitted to look at its costs that way, and ultimately the FLEC study is designed to take that into consideration. And if there were anything about that which was not considered to be appropriate or consistent, that would have been appropriately addressed, and that's simply not the case. That they looked at the appropriate costs, they looked at the tax structure, they looked at the debt structure, they utilized the principles that have been articulated by the FCC to include all of those costs and to make sure that those were accurately reflective of what Kennebec's ultimate expenses are and how they've chosen to capitalize those.
In a few instances, it seems that we're talking about web self-serve or Kalea. There's been some, and please correct me if I'm wrong, there's been some acknowledgement that maybe those services weren't required for the termination of a call. I mean, if the commission were to find these little areas, I mean, you've asked for the commission to, you know, accept the rates as you've put them in here. Can we do that? I mean, are those numbers de minimis, or would the commission need to say, you know, listen, we've got all of these things that even you sort of acknowledge might not rightfully belong in here. Go back and recalculate the numbers.
I would submit that what may not rightfully belong in there was actually excluded from the FLEC study. And there are certain things that if you read through the transcript, I know what you're talking about with regard to Mr. Weber's testimony in Kalea, web self-care, I think Centrix was discussed. And I believe Mr. Weber did acknowledge that perhaps Centrix and the web self-care may not be ultimately includable in the FLEC study. And those are things that Mr. Eklund excluded. To the extent that there's a Kalea cost, I think that is necessary to terminate the call, and that's because that is, in fact, required by federal law, and it's certainly not something that I don't think Alltel would propose violating the law, nor is that something which these petitioners are able to do. So I think in that regard, that cost is appropriate to the ultimate cost associated with terminating the Alltel call. It's one of the things, too, when you go back and look at what was ultimately taken out, a lot of those costs are de minimis, because if one looks at the actual numbers that were includable, and I think those are in the FLEC study, if I recall correctly, but the costs that are associated with Centrax and Kalea and the web self-care are ultimately less than that 5% of vertical services that was extracted by Mr. Eklund. So ultimately, that additional 5% of those costs that's pulled out for those vertical services more than compensates for any costs that may, in fact, be associated with the Centrax and the web self-care. So in that regard, while the commission certainly has before it the discretion to look at those particular costs and line item them, if you will, I would submit to you that that's already been appropriately accounted for through not only Mr. Weber's analysis, but then Mr. Eklund's analysis of excluding those secondary vertical services. And that when you look at the total switch investment of, I'm going to get my numbers wrong here, but I think it was over $1 million at the end of the day, those additional costs are less, well less than $100,000. Not even that, I don't think. I'm sorry, about $6,000 or $7,000 of that total. So it's not something that's going to have an ultimate impact on the bottom line, and they already have been excluded.
So just to clarify, because I didn't remember that from the hearing, but Centrex and the web self-care, those were not included in the flex study.
I don't believe those were.
Okay.
If one actually, because, well, and let me take that back, and perhaps what I did was misspoke there. Those are things that are specifically referenced by Mr. Weber and having built his network. But I don't think Mr. Eklund specifically said, let's take those two out. But what he did was when he came up with the listing of vertical services, he had that 5% to account for it.
Okay, that makes sense.
I apologize if I misspoke.
I mean, with Kalea, though, I mean, it may be necessary to terminate a call, but that's not really the standard for inclusion, is it?
I think it's something that in this particular case is necessary for the termination of a call. And if Allfell's argument to date has been that we're attempting to put all of these costs into the study that aren't associated in any way with voice traffic or Allfell's use of the network, I think that's an inappropriate argument. And so, well, I think the standard is slightly different than what we're discussing at the moment. I think it's important to have that in there. And again, I think that the cost associated with that is so de minimis in the grand scheme of things that it's not something that this commission needs to be particularly worried about in looking at the ultimate costs. I think the focus needs to be on the switch itself and the more significant costs associated with the network than the costs associated with the Kalea and the Centrex and the web self-care, because ultimately those have been taken care of through the FLAC model's calculations and the exclusion of that 5%.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, next on my list are some questions about the SS7, but I don't know if that's how you want to proceed or if you've got an order of topics you want to address.
I don't have an order. Why don't you just go ahead and proceed with the questions that you have, and we'll go through that.
Ms. Moore, if the commission were to find that SS7 data is an appropriate proxy for a reasonable estimation of how that traffic goes, wouldn't there be some benefit to updating that study to better integrate the changes that Allfell has made in the network? Now, I do understand the arguments that have been made about how that can be gamed, but isn't there access to historical data that maybe, say, January to June of 2008? Still backward-looking to hopefully minimize the opportunities to game the data, but still more a better representation of what the network might look today and in the next 3 years?
There are certainly different things that could be taken into account if that were to be rerun to account for network changes. In looking back, one of the reasons in this particular case why we used the data from that particular time frame and chose not to rerun the studies at this particular time was that there could also be factors that would ultimately be in the petitioner's favor with regard to the changing of the network. The Alltel network added a significant number of customers in neighboring MTAs that are likely being delivered on the local facilities in this particular case. So if you look at the evolution of the network involved, there are changes that go both ways. And so ultimately, with the methodology itself being sound, it was intended to account for some of those factors at that time. And I think that in looking at the trends, in looking at the new Alltel network and some of those changes, it could very well result in a much higher inter-MTA factor than what has been advanced. And one of the things that certainly can be done with regard to historical data is to take a look back at that. I'm likely not the best person to tell you whether that's available, because if I recall correctly, the SS7 data was obtained through SDN and some of the other folks out there who I assume have that. But I can't tell you for sure how far back we can go to ensure that there is actually historical data available. That's one of the reasons why, in this particular case, when we looked at the SS7 analysis that had been done, looked at the potential changes to the Alltel network, took into consideration not only Alltel's arguments, but also some of the changes that are readily apparent when looking at that with the addition of customers, the previously proposed SS7 methodology is likely still a very accurate representation of that PIU factor that should be utilized. This commission certainly has in its discretion the ability to tell these petitioners that they need to take a look at a new snapshot in time. I believe the first study analyzed about a two-week period, and there is certainly something that could be done there to account for that if that was what this commission chose to do. However, with regard to the various changes in the network, I think those were fairly accounted for in Mr. Thompson's pre-filed testimony in this case.
I just have one thing I hate to interrupt. We only have a court reporter until noon, so we have about 20 minutes. If we could shorten our answers, that would maybe help a little bit. But thank you. And the questions, too. I can shorten the questions. Ms. Moore, in earlier in discussing SS7 data, you noted that traffic studies aren't unusual. You may have even used the word like commonplace or typical in the telecommunications arena. Why the resistance from your clients in using a traffic study to determine minutes of use for inter-MTA traffic?
I'm sorry?
Intra-MTA traffic for the calculation and billing.
Sure. In this particular case, I think what was being proposed by Alltel was a little bit different in that regard, and that they were actually looking at numbers that may have been negotiated as opposed to based on the actual traffic being exchanged between the parties. And to simply accept what had been advanced to these particular petitioners that didn't comport with their own measurement of their own traffic wasn't acceptable to them.
I mean, I think Alltel has said that they performed a study in January 2008. Is there a reason, I mean, if studies are typical, is there a reason that in this instance with intra-MTA that the study done by Alltel should be rejected by the commission?
I think in this case there is, Commissioner, because if you look at that particular study, that same data that was employed in the January 2008 study was also, I think, used with respect to the inter-MTA data. And it was essentially an initial acknowledgement by Alltel that they were accepting the petitioner's data, the older data, to be true. And so ultimately, I think if you look back to the data that's being proposed by Alltel, it's not the most reliable data that's proposed. I think they were using that study more as illustrative of how they proposed to do it, as opposed to be an actual representation of what that currently is.
Mr. Wazork, any comment about that?
I'd say to our original brief, page 40, as to the factor billing, which I understand you're asking about factor billing, the last part. There was a study done in 2008. I specifically asked Mr. Davis whether they contested those numbers, and he stated they looked at the numbers just to determine whether Williams' analysis was correct. They did not contest those as being accurate. The RLEX big complaint, as I understand their testimony, is we have to bill, so you should have to collect and bill, too, rather than do a factor bill. As to the SS7 question you asked, it doesn't make a difference at all under an SS7 analysis whether Alltel adds a million customers in Nebraska, because when Alltel got rid of the Western Wireless switch in Nebraska, all those customers are being delivered over long-distance carriers, so that doesn't even come into consideration on the SS7 analysis. So, I mean, to say that because we have more customers in surrounding states and other MTAs, you know, it doesn't really change the factor. If anything, it might lower it, because the important thing is how it's being switched and delivered, not, you know, not just because you added the number of customers.
Good, thanks. Commissioner Hansen, any questions on this issue?
Just one, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely.
I would be interested hearing from both parties. Based on the testimony that I've heard and the answers to the questions that were just given, it would appear to me that both parties agree that the SS7 studies should be updated. Is that correct?
Commissioner Hansen, Talbot Wysorek going first. It's our position that the POI study is the better study. It's clear that the SS7 study, it was for a company that no longer exists, and it wouldn't be part of this agreement. And if the commission was inclined to use the SS7 study, it would probably have to be updated. Altel did a snapshot analysis and provided numbers that they think are current in part of their analysis, and we'd advocate for the adoption of those numbers if the SS7 is preferred.
All right, thank you. And Ms. Moore?
Thank you, Commissioner. I certainly think that the SS7 study can be updated if that's the Commission's preference. I think that there is adequate evidence in the record to use the older version, but if it's something wherein to ensure that all network changes are taken into account and that the factor reflects current system, that can be done. It would just need to be done in order to ensure that some of the changes that Altel made at the outset of this arbitration proceeding to change the routing of its traffic could be appropriately accounted for, because I think there were changes made in testimony provided that would artificially drive down that inter-MTA traffic and change the traffic patterns. So that's one of the reasons why it gets a little touchy to update the study, because I'm not convinced that what currently is ongoing is necessarily accurate of what it would have been prior to the commencement of this arbitration proceeding.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. I actually have my questions answered on this one, but how about we turn to Ms. Wiest here? We're running a little short on time. Do you have anything you want to flesh out quick?
On the intra-MTA traffic, the factor billing issue, I know, and this is directed to Ms. Moore, Altel stated that it's unable to capture data handed off to an IXC and delivered to a tandem because the call records indicate the IXC is the originating carrier. Did Arlex dispute that?
We do, Ms. Wiest. I believe Mr. Davis testified to that effect, and that the appropriate records can, in fact, be purchased from SDN. So as to ensure that that can be done, and I think if one looks back at the record testimony and some of the exchanges between Mr. Williams and the commission on that particular subject, there were other things that can, in fact, be done to obtain that appropriate data for Altel to build that traffic. So the RLX do dispute that. It had been the shorter answer. I apologize.
Okay. And then on your definition of inter-MTA and intra-MTA traffic, essentially, aren't you using CDR language for your definition, the connecting cell site? And if you're not really, I know the testimony was that you would prefer a CDR study, but you never actually submitted a CDR study. The only study that's in the record is the SS7 study. So why would we have CDR language to define inter-MTA and intra-MTA traffic?
I think that the definitions that are proposed in the interconnection agreement comport with the FCC's definitions of inter and intra MTA traffic. And ultimately, when looking at those calls, you look at the location of the wireless caller. And I think the CDR is a little bit different ultimately because of the analysis, and shouldn't be viewed as having a negative impact on the definitions that are proposed for inter-MTA traffic there, because what the definitions are attempting to do is to ensure that they categorize the traffic appropriately according to the FCC's definition and ensure that they are that the appropriate cost standards are applied and that they are costed differently, not so much ultimately what's looked at with respect to which study is employed. I think based on prior questions and testimony and litigation, the CDR method generally is accepted to be the most accurate, but because of Altel's claims that it can't come up with that data and do some other sorts of things, the best method that we've proposed then is the SS7, but I don't think that invalidates those definitions. I think it needs to be viewed separate and apart from that.
Okay. And Mr. Eklund came up with total demand, is that correct? For all services, voice and all services?
If I recall correctly, yes.
But he used just 2006 numbers.
If you look at his testimony, what he did is he used the 2006 annualized minutes, and where he was able to do so, he made projections for future demand. But I think his testimony shows you that he thought that was the most conservative because of the trending with regards to the increase in the wireless traffic and the decrease in the other traffic.
Yeah, but for other services, he didn't project any increase in demand.
I do not believe so, no.
That's all I have for those issues.
Any other questions? You want to continue on?
No, go ahead.
I've got some questions about the point of interconnection. So I'm changing topics. Have you got something on?
No, I don't.
There's more. We heard Mr. Wazorek briefly outline what the Altel briefs indicate as their approach toward the PLOY issue. And then in your brief on page 18, the initial brief, you note that Altel relies upon 47 U.S.C. 25, or rather 251C2, to support its claim that it may interconnect at any technically feasible point on an RLEX network. You say, however, this is an inappropriate reading of the rule. If you could better explain your approach, your client's approach toward the PLOY issue, and then specifically what you meant in your brief by that.
Mr. Commissioner, I believe I have a different brief in front of me than what is currently...
I'm sorry, it was your reply brief. I was wrong, and it's on the bottom of page 18 and the top of page 19. So the error is mine.
If you will give me one moment to grab that, please. This relates, this particular issue relates to the pre-filed testimony of Mr. Davis. And in looking at this, Altel essentially in its brief is arguing with response to an RLEC network. And if one looks at 251C2, that relates specifically to the local exchange carrier's obligation to connect. And there are different obligations imposed under 251C2 than there are with respect to RLEX in this particular case. And so the point was that that particular section applies to the incumbent local exchange carriers, not the rural local exchange carriers, because those rural local exchange carriers, for some of the reasons we talked about earlier this morning, actually have particular protections that are afforded to them as rural local exchange carriers. And if one looks at the particular protections employed, they aren't responsible for providing services that are, in fact, outside of their networks. And so that when one looks at 251C2, it's in effect broadening the obligations that shouldn't, in fact, be imposed on the RLECs in this case.
So if the obligations are different for an RLEC, what guidance has the Commission or federal statutes provided to RLECs in this point of interconnection situation?
Well, I think in that particular connection, what the FCC has indicated is that RLECs aren't responsible or aren't required to interconnect outside of their exchange boundaries. And I would submit that that's what Altel has argued for with regard to requesting the MSC as a potentially proposed point of interconnection. And I think, again, this morning, we actually may have a little bit more agreement on this issue than what we may have even before today, because if I understood Mr. Wazorek correctly, he's not going to attempt to force the RLECs in this particular case to interconnect at that particular point. But from the perspective of looking at that issue, he's looking at it from the standpoint of, again, interconnection requirements, and Alltel as a wireless carrier isn't actually subject to any of the interconnection requirements. So to a certain extent, Alltel's argument doesn't comport either with the rules that it's attempting to apply to the RLX in this particular case.
Okay, thanks. That helps. Mr. Wazorek, any comment?
Yeah, I think the points that where Alltel should be able to unilaterally connect, I don't believe anybody can argue, are not on the RLX network. I mean, if they bring a meet point to SDN, if, say, Santel means brings a meet point to SDN in Mitchell, their network extends to Mitchell. Now, what I hear them saying is, yeah, but our service territory doesn't, so we don't have to connect there. I guess if this commission's going to say that, to me, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense that we bring our network to Mitchell, but that's not technically feasible, or we're not going to connect necessarily there, but we're going to connect. You have to bring it all the way to our service territory. That's what I understand her distinctions being at this point, and I think the statutes allow to go to the RLX network.
Thanks very much. Mr. Chairman, I mean, I just might have a comment, but I mean, I'll save that until after all the questions have been had.
Yeah, Commissioner Hansen, do you have any questions?
In light of the time, I don't know that any of my questions are pressing. I can, I believe, find and balance the information from the testimony, both written and oral. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I just have one question on the point of interconnection. Is Alltel insinuating by any means that a call would be, say it was originated, it would have to be terminated in Minneapolis if it was originated in, say, Brookings?
No, because the difference being is if this is unilateral. It's not mutual. So I can't force the RLEC to come to any other meet point that they're not already at. Just those identified. So, but if the RLEC wanted to bring the traffic for whatever reason to Alltel Switch, they could say, hey, we want to just bring the traffic. Now, the current RLECs, maybe that's not a big issue with, you know, maybe an RLEC right outside of Sioux Falls would just soon drop it off at Alltel Switch or at Quest Switch, you know, where the meet point is. Most of them use SDN, but we've got that they could bring the traffic to the SDN. We'd do allow them to set a ploy at our meet point at SDN.
Okay.
So that's their call on that second half. We can't force them to do that. That might be confused because there was some discussion early as to whether there would be locations where you could force the other side to exchange traffic. Alltel's backed away from that and said, no, here's, and these are just the points where we can say, we want to bring our traffic to and connect with you at.
Okay.
And then the RLEX can say, we're going to bring our traffic and connect here with you.
Okay. That concludes my questions, Mr. Johnson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to add, and I know the parties have worked very hard over, you know, many, many months and have settled a number of these issues. As I struggle with these issues, it appears to me that the appropriate resolution for many of the questions before the commission lies somewhere between the arguments advanced by each of the parties. And it's very difficult for a commission to write an order the record has been put together by the parties. You know, a very, very partisan record. And it may be difficult for us to write a strong order that I think explains why we might cut the baby in half in a particular instance. Certainly it's the commission's job to make decisions, and we'll make whatever decisions we have to. I would just ask the parties that if there are residual areas where understanding has been greater understanding has been found in the last few weeks, that perhaps those issues could be taken off the table, because I think you're going to be a whole lot happier with what you get talking to one another than what you're going to get from us. So, and certainly if my colleagues disagree with me, you know, let me know. I don't speak for the commission.
No, I would agree. Anytime you're put in a situation, there's a right and a wrong and yes and a no, and it depends on who we're going to agree with, that not everybody's going to be happy, that's for sure.
Well, these are just such business decisions that in many ways cry out for, and you've done a very good job. I don't want to take away from that. You look at the matrix, and there are a lot more settled. Well, there are probably about as many settled as there are not settled. So, again, thank you to the parties for your endeavors on that front over a lot longer than we've been involved.
Yes, thank you for making the long trips here today, and especially with the weather. So, any other questions? Hearing none, that docket will be closed. We do have one more thing that we need to address, but we can let Sherry go, and we can continue on with our business. Thank you. All right. Chairman Hansen. In under leadership, we have issue number one. We have the election of a chairperson and a vice chairperson of the commission. The question today before the commission is, how shall the commission provide for its executive leadership? Currently, Commissioner Hansen is the chairman, Commissioner Kovac is the vice chairman, and Commissioner Johnson is the presiding commissioner.
You said that well. I thought you were going to say he's the man Friday.
are there any motions? The floor will entertain any motions.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I think that first we should entertain oral arguments.
We could, I suppose we could take an hour recess and come back to address this matter, but...
Well, we could hear oral arguments from staff, but I don't know that I want to hear what they'd have to say.
I was going
to
say that may not end well, so we may not want to do that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may make remarks prior to my making a motion.
Yes, sir, please.
Thank you. It's interesting through the United States and chatting with other commissioners and, of course, in looking at surveys, it shows that there are, few elected commissions similar to ours and that fewer commissions still actually rotate the chairmanship. And in many instances, chairs are appointed for the duration that they are elected or appointed. And I think it's a very healthy order that we've adopted. I think it gives us not only each of us an opportunity to see what that challenge is like, but it gives the opportunity to experience different events within the commission. And I would at this time like to, and I will, nominate my good friend and a very capable fellow commissioner, Dusty Johnson, for chair of the PUC, and would make that effective immediately, and that it should continue through the year. I don't know if we can make an election for 2 years at a time or not, but that would be my intent. However, this may be something that we have to revisit on an annual basis. I'm not certain. So my motion will be that to elect Dusty Johnson as chair for the PUC beginning immediately and to continue through the year 2009.
All right. And I guess I'll second that motion, even though we don't do motions and seconds, but that pretty much would pin Commissioner Johnson to a wall there if I do second the motion. So any comments, Commissioner Johnson?
I think it's good we're just doing 1 year at a time because we might as well keep some leverage in you guys' hands, make me behave myself.
All right, the motion has been made. Any further discussion? Hearing none. Commissioner Johnson.
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
And Commissioner Kovac votes aye. Congratulations, Mr. Commissioner Johnson.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Why don't you go ahead and run the balance of the meeting? Or not, you don't want to?
Well,
we still have a vice chair, then.
You're the chair.
All right, fine. With that, the question before the commission is who shall serve as vice chair for the next year. Are there any motions? I forgot what we discussed last year, but I think, Gary, it's your year to be vice chairman, isn't it?
No, we were going to make Steve vice chair for 2 years while you are chair for 2 years.
All right, well...
Would be chair for 2 years after that, and I would be his vice chair.
There we go.
So I will make a motion that my other good friend, I only have two of them, and my other that my other good friend, Commissioner Steve Kolbeck, be elected as the vice chair of the PUC, beginning immediately and continuing through the year 2009.
A motion has been made. No second is required. Is there any additional discussion? You're a heck of a guy. There ain't no further discussion. I'll proceed to vote. Commissioner Hansen?
Aye.
Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye.
Commissioner Johnson votes aye. The motion carries 3-0. And, of course, Gary said nice things about everybody else, so we might as well also say that Gary has done a very good job as chairman. And the nice thing about the three of us is we work together very well, and I don't know that we particularly care who's running the meetings in any given year, but the work of the commission moves forward, and certainly thanks for everything you've done, Gary.
Well, thank you for relieving me of the tremendous weight of the of the chairmanship. I thank you for the kind words, and congratulations to both of you. I know the PUC is in excellent hands.
All right. Is there any further business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we'll stand adjourned.
Thank you.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you.
Safe travels.